expanding on all of the top sports headlines. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Friday. This is Writer's Block. Jeff Blair alongside Tim Leeper. Sitting in for Richard Deitch, who's often parts unknown. I think doing secret inside stuff that we can't report on. How you doing, Leap?
That's probably some really good stuff. I'd love to know what he's doing.
It's pretty deep. It's pretty deep.
I got some big shoes to fill here.
You do and you don't. Let's put it that way. The shoes aren't always as big as people think they are. Tim Leeper, of course, former first base coach with the Toronto Blue Jays. And I will get this earphone thing straightened out here. Lot to talk about baseball-wise today, of course. The winter meetings start on Sunday. Shai Davidi, Ben Nicholson, Smith, Hazel May will have you covered. Ricky Romero, Blue Jays alumni, will join us in studio. You didn't cross paths with Ricky, did you?
Not a little bit. I was here. First year was 13. I was roving around the minor leagues, and obviously that was a real trying year for him. Yep. The one thing about it was I was on the perimeter of it, and the one overwhelming feeling I got from everybody in the organization was how much guys really pulled for him and how much guys really loved him. And I remember every time we'd get on a charter and we'd go out to L.A., you know, Ricky was always there to pick guys up. They all hang out. He was a guy that really built it and brought guys together. And, you know, it was a shame I didn't get to know him. And it was interesting watching it from my vantage point.
Yeah, the two guys that, you know, I've always said that I really kind of, I want to see everybody have a healthy career. But the two guys I feel genuinely annoyed about not being healthy is him and Devin Travis. And I put the two of them in the same category.
That's probably a pretty good thing. And yeah, Devin, obviously, like, what a class individual.
Yeah.
And what
yeah.
a really, really good player.
Yeah. Hopefully somebody gives him a shot, and hopefully he stays in the game. So Ricky Romero joins us at 2:25, and we'll talk about the winter meetings, which begin in San Diego on Monday. The Jays haven't signed anybody yet. Michael Pineda off the board now, signing a 2-year, $20 million deal with the Minnesota Twins. So we'll talk to Ricky about that. Want to talk to him about the Raptors losing 119-109 to the Houston Rockets last night. And I was thinking about this in sort of an overall sports context, because Nick Nurse made the decision to double team James Harden. And essentially the decision was, we'll take him out of we'll try to force him to get rid of the ball as soon as possible, and then hope that we've got everybody else covered, or hope that the one guy we can't numerically cover has a bad night. Russell Westbrook didn't have a great night.
27.
Unfortunately, just about everybody else did. And I was thinking, this is sort of the classic coach's manager's dilemma, isn't it? If you take a guy out of the game and somebody else just goes off, you just kind of throw your hands up in the air and go, you know, we James Harden, what, 23 points? That's a good 10 minutes for him in most nights. We got rid of him, but these other guys are going to hit. There's nothing we can do.
If it's the playoffs, are you happy with your outcome here? Like, I mean, these are the things that...
No, it's a great point.
The season records or the season games are really important, because this is great. This goes into the experience chips box, and, you know, when they face them in the playoffs, if they face them, it'd be in the finals. But, like, do they do it again? And I think the answer is, like, yes. I mean, you held Harden. Harden took 11 shots, you know, and
He had one shot in the first quarter. Think about that. One shot in the first quarter.
Which also shows what a great player he is, because he adjusted and he accepted the fact that they were going to guard him, and he was able to dish the ball off. And luckily, obviously, they killed it from the three-point line.
Yeah, it's it will be interesting to see when the teams meet again what Nick Nurse does. I mean, I'm with you. I run it out. I run the same thing out there. And, you know, you just got to hope that the other guys aren't going to be as good as they were.
If you say this before the beginning of the game, that Westbrook goes goes 7 for 27, even though he had the triple-double, but he was 7 for 27, and you hold Harden to 11 shots,
yeah,
like you would take that. But sometimes like it's a situation where like you got to be careful what you ask for, right?
Because they had everybody else at 19 three-pointers. Think about it.
We were in the WBC in Arizona. I forget. It was like right. a couple ago, and we're like, if we can just get to the eighth with Jimmy Henderson and Axford, we're gold.
Right.
And we got to the eighth with Jimmy Henderson and Axford, and like the same, kind of like last night, same thing. Like it didn't go the way you wanted it to. But I think if you do it, draw it up again, you do exactly the same thing. To keep those guys at bay like they did,
yeah,
that's pretty good. I love Nick Nurse.
Oh, I do too. And it was funny, Mike D'Antoni talking to us after the game last night, the Rockets coach, and he said it was like 7 minutes. He said 7 minutes into the game, and Harden was over by the bench, and I said, so how do you want to play the first quarter? Like, basically, do you want to come out? When do you want me to take you out? He said, Coach, I'm not doing anything. I'm standing up here. He said, all right, well, then I might as well stay out here. And D'Antoni said, all right, play. I mean, if you're just going to stand there and suck up two guys. But, yeah, it's, you know, you've been in these discussions. How do you go about telling a team, don't let this guy beat us? Like, can you do that realistically?
It's so funny because we say that, and then, like, we never really give follow-up instructions.
Right? How to do it.
Like, but, I take back, like, Cleveland. Like, when we faced Cleveland in the playoffs, their whole deal was Edwin. They didn't want Edwin to beat him. So they expanded on that a little bit. They said, we're going to throw them nothing but breaking balls, and they're either going to be really quality strikes or they're going to be below the zone. And if we walk them, we don't care. So that's kind of what you go into. In basketball, I don't know how you say don't let a guy beat you unless you're doing what you did last night. Sometimes it was like it was a box and one. Sometimes it was a triangle and two. Sometimes there was three guys on him and they collapsed on him. I guess that's the way. But, you know, I think this goes to everything. It's like probably we're going to talk about today when it comes to hockey and everything. That's when other guys get a chance to step up. And your really good teams have good role players that are in these situations. This is where guys step up, and this is what makes you like a really good team. And Houston showed last night why they're really close to being in the finals every year, because they had guys step up and in a situation where they essentially shut their two best guys down.
Have you ever been in a situation where you guys are talking to a player and you're sort of saying, you know, do this, don't do this, and the guy just goes, I can't do that. Like Barker always tells a story about, you know, he used to hate it when coaches say, take the ball the other way. I can't. It's not that easy. I can't do it. If I could do it, don't you think I'd be trying it?
Hey, you just got to pitch this guy in. I don't know. If you throw him splits, he's going to get out every time. Yes. Well, I don't have a split.
Well, then go find one. But I mean, when you have to be careful when you talk to guys or when you're game planning for a specific player, regardless of the sport.
Absolutely. And again, it's saying that don't beat them, don't let them beat you, but also like you really have to expand on that and you have to really explain like what that means. Because a lot of times I think we say a lot of things. It happens in the major leagues. It happens in the minor leagues a lot. Like you say things and you don't really back it up, and you left the players, they're more confused than when the conversation started. And that's the one thing, that's good coaching. You just can't let that happen.
Is it different now with analytics than before? Like can you make more of a case to a player because you have analytics now? You can shove him a sheet of paper and go, look, this, you know, this is what he does when we throw him this. This is what he does when we throw him this. Throw him that.
Yeah, but it's only as good as the guy that's getting the information, whether he receives it that way. So the greatest thing about coaching is making hard things sound really, really easy and explaining it in a way that the guy understands. And each player is a little bit different. Some guys are visual. Some guys can see, you know, they can see it on a piece of paper. Some guys, they can look at words and you can tell them and they can get it. Some guys are feel guys. So the key of coaching, is it easier with analytics? I think for you to have facts to back up what you're saying, that makes you feel better. But at the same time, if you don't get it across to the players, it's irrelevant.
Who have you been around, players who just can absorb stuff like that? Is there a guy who stands out who just, you know, you tell him something once and it's locked in there and he does it?
JD was one. And the best players are like that. Andrew McCutchen was unbelievable at that. Your better ones, like, you don't have to overcoach them. You have to spend a lot of time, like, explaining things. Like, that's difficult. You know the guy. It doesn't mean he's not going to be good, but it makes it a little bit more challenging. Mm-hmm. There are certain guys that I've managed where, like, you can just make a quick statement and you don't have to kill them. And it actually saves your relationship because the guy doesn't feel like you're up in him all the time.
See, I would think JD would have been difficult.
he's so smart. Like, that was the one thing. You don't get to be that good a player without having some sort of intelligence. And, like, he understood concepts. He understood the whole game and the big picture of the game. Justin Smoak was the same way. Like, he saw the big picture of the game. You know, JD was a much different player because he was offensive, defense. He could run. He could do everything. So when you asked me that question, that's the one guy that came to mind because he understood everything. And, again, it didn't take much of an explanation or no explanation for him to understand what you were talking about.
Were you surprised at how – not how smart he was. I'm not going to say that, but – were you surprised at how he was able to process stuff that way?
Not surprised. I look at everybody a little bit differently, and I never really get shocked by guys.
Okay.
And I always have said this as a coach, like, guys have the ability to so outplay my knowledge, and I don't want to get in their way. And so, like, I take more of a stance where I just kind of look at them, and I just kind of absorb how they absorb things and how they put things to work. And for him, like, it was one of those things. Again, you can make a quick mention of something and you could do it right away. McCutchen was great. Say, hey, Andrew, I know you don't usually go the other way, but hey, he's going to throw you a slider away and go the other way, why don't you give it a shot? And he could actually pull it off. So those are your good players when you can do stuff like that.
Now, we are, as we mentioned, getting close to the start of the winter meetings. What's this time of year like for baseball people? But and not just general managers and managers, but the season's been over. You started the offseason. I presume that maybe there's been some work at the facility with different players and all that. But now we're kind of getting into the time of year where decisions are made about new players coming in and about players going. What's this like for an organization as you approach the winter meetings?
God, there's so many different aspects because obviously the front office is way in on everything, and their job never stops. And as a coach, your job pretty much stops. I mean, for me as a coach, the one thing I always do is assessing the year before, which I've already probably done by now, or hopefully I've done by now, unless I just went on a long bender or something because of a tough year. But you assess the situation, you're starting to get in contact with guys because they're starting their off-season workouts. And for me, you always wanted to make sure that, like, the things that you were going to preach to them in spring training, that they knew it way beforehand, because I wanted them to hit the ground running. Even though it's 7 weeks long, you want them to hit the ground running there. And you don't have, like, as a coach, you don't have a ton of contact with the front office in terms of, like, who's going to come in. So you're just kind of basically watching MLB trade rumors. Mm-hmm. You're listening to the radio. You're watching MLB TV to kind of find out, like, if stuff's going on. You kind of get wind of things that are going to happen before they happen, but you don't get a lot of time. And then at that point, when you're a coach, you become kind of reactionary.
Yeah, no, I was wondering because I know that, you know, some teams I've covered, you know, even the Montreal Expos at times, they would take their whole coaching staff down, major league staff with them to the winter meetings. And basically it would be just scatter, you know, guys, go and talk to guys. And it, you know, if somebody had a pre-existing relationship with an organization, you know, the responsibility, go and talk to, I'm going to pick a name, go and talk to the Marlins, to their senior scout, you know, the Marlins senior scouting guy, go and talk to them and just kind of, and chat them up a bit. Were you ever told to do that at winter meetings or anything like that? Yeah, were you ever brought down?
I've never gone to winter meetings, but, like, a lot of organizations will call you. Like, I get calls all the time from other organizations that are looking into players, and they know you have a history with them. And it's funny, some of the better organizations, they really, if you go just to the top guys, they're going to see it the way they see it. I think the best organizations, the guys that do their best homework, are the guys that go talk to clubhouse guys, go talk to teammates in the minor leagues, talk to people that like them, talk to people that don't, and try to get a better feel for that. I just went through an interview process with one team, and at first I wasn't even considering the job, but the fact that they were so thorough, and I was so impressed by who they contacted, because they obviously did their homework to do that, that it actually made me think, like, this is the kind of organization you want to work for. I mean, they're thorough. They know the right questions to ask, and that's important, because there's so many times you go on interviews, and I've been going through interview process now, where I walk away from the interview where I feel like the people don't ask you the right questions, and they didn't know anything more about me than they knew before they got. And it's like, Ben Sherrington gave me one of the best interviews I ever had as a young coach, where he actually asked good information. But holding an interview and being able to extract the information that you want and you need and to get the things that you're looking for, it's a bit of an art and it's a bit of a science. And like, the more thorough you are, it may be a little bit more time consuming, but you also, like, I think it serves you very well to do that.
Is there stuff you, not just you personally, but let's say that I'm a general manager and I'm looking at signing a free agent. He played for your team last year. I contact you. We have a pre-existing relationship. I go, you know, hey, Tim, just between us, like, what can you tell me about this guy? Is there stuff you wouldn't say? You wouldn't You wouldn't reveal?
Your reputation's on the line when you do that. So, like, if a guy's a turd and then you say he's great and he goes the other team, like, you're never going to get those questions again and you lose your credibility. I think there's a way, I think especially sometimes in baseball, probably all of work, there's a way of saying things without actually saying them.
Mm-hmm. And it's a piece of work.
Yeah. You know, high risk, high reward is always my, this is my go-to one now.
Yeah.
Because I got a lot of calls on guys that we had here the last few years, and we were a little volatile. I don't know if people knew that. But we were.
People. But just a little volatile.
It's high risk, high reward.
Exactly. But that, and there's, but there's, again, I guess, as you say, it's your reputation stake. So if you are withholding stuff, you have to make sure you don't withhold stuff that's, you know, you don't want to send the guy, have him go over there and find out that he's got a, you know, a police record that's 14 pages long and that the organization knew about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Something, and it covers all aspects. It covers him mentally. It covers him, what he does physically, how he is as a teammate, all those things. And, you know, you gotta walk a fine line between giving too much, but also, like again, it's your credibility in it. That's important.
Are you surprised by the way the baseball offseason's gone so far? I mean, there seems to be a few more decisions being made, not necessarily in the big guys, although Zach Wheeler would qualify. But there seemed to have been more decisions made earlier this year than maybe we expected.
Well, last year was so slow, so I think anything was going to be an upgrade from last year. But I think it shows you the teams that are really trying. I mean, obviously Atlanta's a little bit ahead of it right now, and if they signed JD, you look at what they've added. Like, it's pretty good. And you see teams that are, like, kind of, like, hunkering down. And, like, the one thing I look at it, and, again, this is not a conscious decision I make, but when you see guys like Jonathan Villar and Kevin Pillar not get tendered, like, you kind of see where it's going. And for me, it's all kind of heading towards the next CBA and what's going to change. Because, you know, Villar was like a four-win player and played 162 games. And, like, he was a really good player
for the
Orioles.
2 years ago, I mean, there was talk of, you know, you talked about Jonathan Villar. You were talking about having to trade a significant player to get him 2 years ago.
And then he performed the way that he outperformed every the year he's ever had, and he was a really good player. And then
on a bad team,
and to be cut loose like that from a team that could probably still use him, like that's tough. Like, if you play 162 games for a team and have that kind of year, and then, like, that team doesn't want you back, like, that's a difference in the game. I don't know. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but it's a difference.
How do you when something like that happens and a player like that is available? How would you as an organization? How would you approach that player? And by that, I mean, would you jump on him right away? Would you try to slow play? Like, let's say there's a player you're interested in. I'm thinking of a guy like Cesar Hernandez of the Phillies. Jays have had interest in him in the past. I don't know if they do now. They have a pretty good second baseman. See if that second baseman is there at the start when the season opens. But do you jump on a guy right away? Or do you, in a case like that, do you think most teams kind of slow play the market?
I think you better, if you want your team to be good and you have an idea and you've already know that this guy is the guy you want, I think you make the moves. I think you go after it and do it. Because otherwise, if you slow play, you risk losing the guy. Mm-hmm. And I don't, for me, I wouldn't do that. I mean, again, I think it's everybody's comfort level of what they do. But for me, if you've done your homework and you say, this guy, if Cesar Hernandez, we'll use him as an example, if he's a fit, and then you let him get through the cracks, then like, shame on you. Like, I would want to get the players that I want. And I would have already done my homework before. I would have earmarked, hey, I want this player, this player, this player. And I go hard after him immediately because you just don't want to lose those guys.
We have Tim Leeper alongside me today in studio. Richard Deitch is on assignment. John Clayton, host and NFL analyst in 710 ESPN Seattle, host of the Schooled with the Professor podcast, will be along. Joy Vitale, he is a St. Louis Blues radio analyst. Ren Lavoie, Eric Smith. The Leafs and Blues play tomorrow night on Hockey Night in Canada. The Leafs making a little bit of personnel news today. We'll deal with all that, but when we come back, Ricky Romero, Blue Jays alumni, joins us in studio. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360. The Blue Jays Winterfest is Saturday, January 18th through Sunday, January 19th at the Rogers Center. You can go to BlueJays.com Winterfest for tickets. Among the confirmed guests, the confirmed alumni, Juan Guzman, Tom Henke, Robbie Alomar, Pat Henkin, Cito Gaston, and the gentleman to my right, joining Tim Leeper and myself, Ricky Romero. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too. How's everything?
And everything's good. So yeah. Did you like your TV stint this season with the Vancouver Canadiens?
It was a learning experience, that's for sure. It was, it's different when you're up there in the booth and you really don't know what's going on and everything happens so fast. Mm-hmm. And it was a learning experience. I actually got to talk to Pat Tabler about it a lot. So he gave me some pointers and having Rob Fay there to kind of help a lot. So it was cool. And everything, I think every show, it got better. Mm-hmm. And it was a fun thing to do.
So you've seen some of their prospects.
Yeah, I saw some of them. I saw Manoah throw. Yeah. I saw Clausen.
What'd you think of him?
Good stuff, man.
He's a big man, isn't he?
Big boy. Big boy. Klopfenstein, I mean, mm-hmm. got great stuff. And, you know, from what I heard, their makeup is what makes them. And, you know, obviously the Blue Jays saw something in them to bring them in. And they should be able to help, hopefully, here soon. Probably Manoah more than anybody because he's a little bit more polished and more ahead. But
right.
No, what are you doing now with yourself? I saw on your Twitter feed, I saw you did a camp over in East Los Angeles for the kids back home. I thought it was awesome. But can you tell me a little bit about that? Because it was really fascinating.
Yeah, it was one of those things where it started as a joke between me and my friends. It was organized all by my friends. None of us have like marketing experience or any of that, but somebody knows somebody and somebody knows somebody that makes shirts and this. And so we started putting our ideas together. I'd always wanted to do something there. I just didn't know how I could pull it off. And so we did, and it was awesome. I mean, for East LA to have, for us to have that kind of impact there, it was great because I had a lot of former players, current players come out, and, you know, we try to kind of base it on inner city kids that don't get the exposure. I brought in scouts from three scouts from different teams. Just, hey, you might find a diamond in the rough. Mm-hmm. You never know. So just more to motivate these kids. We brought in a USC, somebody that works at the University of Southern California to come and talk to these kids about filling out an application, dealing with the NCAA clearinghouse, because there's so many steps that you have to do in order to play Division mm-hmm. One or Division Two, whatever it is that you play. So it was very informative, and I think they all enjoyed it.
I was going to ask you, you know, one of the things that baseball is sort of struggling with right now is, and it's not just baseball, there are other sports as well, but it seems particular to baseball, trying to get more young people involved. We talk about how, you know, they're talking about speeding up the game to try to get more fans watching it. But I think baseball also needs to be aware of the fact that the growing communities in the United States are the Latino community, visible minorities, and you really want to be sure that you got roots in those communities when you're looking at future athletes for the future. Has baseball taken steps in that direction, do you think, Ricky? Is there still more that needs to be done?
Oh, I think there's more that needs to be done. I think these kids there really don't have the exposure. It's pretty much come down to if you don't play in the perfect game tournament, if you're not part of a scout ball team, all that stuff means money. Mm-hmm. And some of these kids don't have those resources, so... When I set out to do this, I said one of my goals is going to be, obviously this was our first one, but the ones in the future, I want to make it bigger to where maybe it becomes kind of a exposure. And if we can change 1, 2, 3, 4 lives mm-hmm. into the future of baseball, then that we've done our job. So I think that's my biggest goal in it. I think I always say it, if I was playing it nowadays, I don't think nobody would have ever found me.
Really?
Yeah, I mean... Like I said,
well, how did you end up going to Fullerton?
Well, it started with the newspaper article.
Okay.
Yeah, I was on the LA Times. I was featured in it, you know, just a high school profile. And then one coach read it and then another coach read it and it kind of blew up. And I just think I was having scouts, Division I coaches come watch me pitch. But now you're not getting anybody because these coaches are all and scouts are going to these perfect games and AFLAC, All-American, whatever tournaments. So
And there's fewer scouts too now, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, they're cutting those out too.
Yeah.
Is the Little League system still strong out there? Because when I was growing up, we were in our city and we had our Little Leagues and we had our house leagues and we had plenty of kids to play. We had fields and it was good and there wasn't the travel ball. But since then, I think the fields have gone away a lot. I go back to my old Little League field like it's gone. And like you said, everybody's doing the things. But yeah. Is there still opportunities for guys in the inner city to play?
I think there is. I just think there's talent out there. There's a lot of talent, but it has to do with money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and them not being able to afford past high school and the showcases and all that. I actually just signed up my 4-year-old for Little League this year. And
mm-hmm.
just to think like $200 is what it costs.
Right.
You know? And I'm like, $200 for a 4-year-old? Like, what are they doing? You know, I mean, when I was growing up, it was $30, $40, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But $200 and it's just
get a uniform and a hat though.
Well, and then we're in the area we live in, because I was disappointed because you don't get to be. I was like, maybe they can be a team, like you know, the mm-hmm. Blue Jays or the whatever team that you get. But it's you got to sponsor a team and then you get to put your business across right. the jersey. That's the way it works there. So I was like, interesting.
Chico's bail bond.
That's exactly what I was gonna think. Chico's bail bond. Exactly that came to mind.
That's the greatest movie. That was the most. My dad was Walter Matthau, which is unbelievable. But we had Z Medical Services.
I remember my first uniform was a company called Uniform Builders of all things. It was a building company in Ottawa. It was a hockey uniform. It was god awful.
Yeah,
it was Boston Bruins colors, and I hated the Bruins.
Us growing up, it was you were either the Dodgers or the White Sox, right. whatever team it was. You know, and my wife is like, well, if you want them to be the Blue Jays, you better sponsor them.
you've got people here. You can take
maybe
care
we
of
can
that.
Make it work, right?
Absolutely. Conversation with Ricky Romero and Tim Leeper. Tim and I were talking about this a little bit. The winter meetings start on Monday in San Diego. And I'm wondering from a player's point of view, Ricky, what's this time of the off season like? You know, with winter meetings coming up and you know that there are going to be trade rumors. What's that like for a player? When you were you following it closely? Were you not concerned but thinking about being traded? Or
no, I don't think I was ever in that area of being worried about being traded,
right.
but you're always wondering what the team's going to do. I mean, Leap, you've been in that clubhouse and part of those teams where you're wondering like, hey, what everyone knows what the necessity is mm-hmm. in the clubhouse. It's no secret. The fans know, everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of waiting. Yeah, you do wait and you're like, what are we going to do? You know, but at the same time, you still got to go about your business. I was out working out, getting ready and preparing.
Did you find that as the winter meetings went, or not as the winter meetings went on, but as the off season went on, and you were focusing on, you know, on preparing, did you find that as you were in the game longer, it was sort of easier to focus on yourself? You know, be a little more. I'm going to say a little more selfish, but it's not the right word. But you know what I mean.
Comfortable.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Was it a little bit easier to do that?
I don't cut out
the background noise.
I kind of always was, you know, I always had that chip on my shoulder, not as a, like, I'm going to go out to prove everyone wrong, but there's somebody trying to take my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter how much money you're making or it doesn't matter. I always kind of carried myself like that. So anytime I got the chance to go out and put a good off-season work, I did it. And,
mm-hmm.
and that was my main focus. And so that when I came into spring training, I was ready to go and I was firing on all cylinders. And you know, that's just, I saw the way as a young rookie, the way Halliday prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that guy doesn't take anything for granted. And he's won Cy Youngs. He's been All-Stars and he's done it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that to heart with me. So as I prepared every offseason, I kind of, you know, just saw
mm-hmm.
just how it went, and that's how I kind of went about it.
Yeah, one thing I want to say to you, like, it was great because I was always around the periphery of you. My first year here was 13, and one thing, my first year as a coach here, like, how much a part of what you were meant to our success. I can remember getting off a plane in Anaheim or in Long Beach, and then everybody was going, hey, we're going over to Ricky's house. And, like, how much people, like, genuinely loved you. And again, I get to witness this a little bit from afar, but like how much you kind of even kept our group in together, even in 14 and 15. And like, and it's one thing about the Blue Jays. And again, this is the reason probably why you're here right now. Like it's really special and it's really great. And it's always been a family. I think part of it's representing a whole country. Cause everywhere you go, you've got people that are out there supporting you no matter where you are. But also I think the players that have played here also kind of adopt that mantra, like kind of from the fans and what the organization is. But like in 14 and 15, when guys were going over to your house and they were getting off planes instead of going out and just going to hotels and you guys were getting guys together, like, I want to thank you. Like you made my life better, but it was a testament to you as an individual, like what you meant to guys. And I got to hear them speak about you and how much guys really genuinely love you.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate
your legacy still lives here.
I appreciate it. I always say it. I mean, one of the greatest things to happen other than the births of my two sons is playing here for the Toronto Blue Jays, and just being, like you said, being able to represent the whole country of Canada everywhere you go, that logo means so much. And I mean, that was one of my biggest goals every time, you know, just make sure I have the guys together and whatever I can do. My mom and dad loved having everyone over every time we'd go to Anaheim, cook up for them and make a nice Mexican meal for them. So it was pretty awesome.
I never got invited.
You're a rookie. That's why I leave. No, I'm just kidding.
Rookie, old coach.
Old coach. You got big league, man. You got big league. All right, I got a first base coach here who used to get into or who's gotten into arguments with teams because they thought you were stealing their signs. Let's face it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a pitcher here. What do you guys read into the Houston Astros? All the talk about the Astros, the technological sign stealing, the banging on the garbage can.
Yeah, I'm all for stealing signs the right way. You know, whether if you're tipping pitches, it's your job as a pitcher to fix it. If they're stealing your signs burner at second base, it's your fault as a pitcher. So I'm all for that. But to go to the technology and the banging of trash cans or whistling, whatever it was, I've watched some of those videos and it's pretty crazy what you see.
So you like, I've watched it too, but I'm watching it like, you know, fan. But you've been out there. You buy that, eh? That they were the banging and the whistling? I mean,
it's undeniable.
Like, yeah. I'm looking at it as a fan. I'm going, well, yeah, okay, maybe.
You've heard guys come out and say, like, I knew something weird was going on, you know? That, I mean, Farquhar was outspoken about it. And he like, saw it or felt it as he was pitching.
Yeah.
And stuff was brought to the league. Like, it wasn't like this was, like, people knew. And even a few years ago when Boston played Houston in the playoffs, and their Boston pitchers, they were telling our guys, you know, that, hey, they hear stuff. And you, there's like, if guys steal signs, like, you don't want to, like, be a tattletale. But, like, at the same time, like, they're taking stuff. Like, I got friends on the Astros staff right now, and I'm thinking about the games we lost. And I'm looking at Tapera out there, like, dealing, having 0-2 counts, and then fouling off, like, really nasty 0-2 sliders to stay in the count to where maybe he hangs. I remember Bregman beat him with a home run one time, and I'm thinking, holy shit, he knew everything that was coming.
That's quite often my reaction when Ryan Tapera was pitching, with all due respect to Ryan Tapera. I'm just being honest here.
But it makes me, like, again, it made me mad. It made me just lose my job here. So I won't be on next segment.
You're fine.
But it's wrong. It's wrong what they were doing to go to those levels to be able to do it. And then, like, to actually be to tell the league, like stuff is happening. And then like nobody really, like, only pay lip service to the investigation. To me, that makes me mad. Because, again, how many guys, like, did get beat? How many coaches lost games to them? Like, it's not right.
Here's what I don't get, though, and I'll ask you guys this. This has gone on for 3 years, let's say.
Yes. Probably more.
Mike Fiers talks about it. Nobody else. And yet after that, you started to hear guys come out. But why wasn't – I mean, somebody must have figured this out with the Astros 4 years ago and wasn't with the organization anymore. And
but I think you see it. You're even seeing it now with the stuff with the coaches and hockey and all that stuff. Like, we've lived playing a sport where, like, you kind of accept it and you want it to stop, but you don't go out and complain about it publicly. I don't know if that's the right way to go about it, because what happens right now is, like, it's a black eye on the game for sure. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the league wants this, you know? And again, I think these things are pretty preventable, but I think as players, like, whatever your makeup is, like, you don't want to go out and, like, make excuses to the public and think that people are stealing stuff from you.
Do you ever think that something was up when you were pitching, that somebody was using something to, not just pitch tipping, but you know, some cameras to steal signs. Or yeah,
in 2012, you know, I had a weird year. That might have been it. No, I honestly, that's one of the things I always worked on, was just making sure I hid my pitches or somebody wasn't stealing signs and stuff like that. We always had a good system between me and my catchers as far as calling certain pitches and stuff like that. But, you know, I always did wonder, like, for me, Boston always hit me really well from start to the end of my career. And I always wondered, so one of the things I asked John Farrell when he came over, I was like, why did you guys hit me so, or why did they hit me so well? You were in there. And I mean, he kind of didn't give me the answer I wanted to hear, but I mean, he just was, he kind of bit around the bush a little bit. I don't know if he probably didn't want to throw him under the bus. I'm not saying they were stealing signs, but.
That one's been documented.
Yeah.
I think. And punished.
Exactly.
And I mean, the only thing he said was like, they take your changeup away. And I was like, okay, well, what does that mean? So, you know, we adjusted a game plan. I remember one game in 2012, me and Jose Molina kind of adjusted a different game plan. We're like, all right, we're going to take away your changeup. We're going to go fastball curveball. And it worked. So maybe that was it, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
You can give me, I can spend all day on this.
Well, yeah, I know you too. Can. Like I said, this was part of your, well, I'll ask you that. I'm going to ask you this. No names. Swear to God, no names.
I'll name everybody.
No names, but you're interviewing for jobs now.
Yes.
Do teams ask you?
Yes.
How good are you at stealing stuff?
I tell them I'm great. And I got to be honest with you.
But you have a reputation of being pretty good at it.
And the reason was because we had a great offensive ball club. Like, we were great. And it was funny because Brian McCann was with the Yankees, and he was always watching me. Like, always. Right. And I could always hear Girardi in the dugout, and they would always make their comments. They were super professional, but I knew they were upset, and they thought I was doing something. I played off that, so I moved around a lot just to kind of play off that a little bit. But as we weren't as good anymore, like 16, 17, and then McCann went to Houston. One game, he didn't look at me the whole game.
And you knew.
So I went over after the game. I said, dude, are we this bad? Can anyone look at me? You know I'm not stealing signs anymore.
Well, remember when we had the whole thing that we thought, everyone thought we had somebody.
Oh, the man in white. I remember that. And it was Alex Rios who kind of started that too with when he went to the White Sox.
When I went to the Giants, I was with Jake Peavy one spring training, and he swore to this day that we were cheating. And I was like, what are you talking about? We sit in fourth place every year. Like,
if we're cheating, it ain't working.
The greatest one, Pete McKinnon was in Philly one day, and I was out of the box, and McKinnon sprints down the end of the dugout and yells at the first baseman, get him in the box. I called the league on this today. Hey, they just came from New York, and I told you guys all about this. Get him back in the box.
Well, you know, it is interesting because I remember when Joe Kerrigan was the Red Sox pitching coach, and I know from when he was in Montreal, he swore. And I can remember him telling me that and it was only the Rogers Center, because he said, you know, they got cameras, and I know they got a camera, and they got it in their dugout, and I know that they got signs and all that, and they got different angles, and you can tell because guys go in the back. He'd go on and on, and I'd go, Joe, it ain't working. They're not very good. And he goes, yeah, but they're still doing it, you know? They're still doing it. But I swear to God, and he'll go to his grave thinking that the Toronto Blue Jays had a technological system set up where they were stealing signs.
So does Jake Peavy. We know there's a guy. We went up to him, and I'm like, save it, dude. No. I've never heard of it. We never heard of it, obviously. Like, all the hitters were like, what are these guys talking about?
Hey, one thing our guys did really well, they picked up pitcher stuff. Like, Deiono Navarro was the absolute best at picking up little things that the pitcher did in his glove or whatever to get signs. And they were great at it. And they would sell out to it, too. That was the other thing. And when they knew a slider was coming, and like Edwin, if Edwin would sit on a slider and if it was a strike, he was gonna get it. Yeah. So that was, not only did they have that kind of information because they picked up little things, they were able to execute on it.
And too. I think that's where it should stay. It should stay in between the lines. Like I said, if somebody's able to pick certain things from a pitcher, then it's your job as a pitcher to be able to fix it. And if there's a runner on second and somebody's looking in and stealing your signs, it's your job to fix it. You know, I'm all for that. That's part of the game. But like I said, when you get to the technological, you know, cameras here, cameras there.
Wait till we have electronic strike zones. And the Russians start hacking into the Major League Baseball strike zone.
I'll be retiring.
Ricky, thanks so much for joining us, man.
For sure.
Saturday, January 18th, Sunday, January 19th at the Rogers Center, BlueJays.com/Winterfest. It is the Blue Jays Winterfest. Trent Thornton, Ryan Barucki, Bo Bichette, Randall Grichuk, Reese McGuire, confirmed guests, alumni, Ricky Romero, Juan Guzman, Tom Henke, Robbie Alomar, Pat Hinkins, Cito Gaston. We'll take a break and be back with more of Writer's Blocks on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet 360. Who's your favorite NFL team, Leaper?
Rams, but it's love and hate. I grew up in L.A., obviously, and it was as a kid, it was great. I went to the last game, I think, at the Coliseum.
Right.
And I think Joe Namath was actually still playing.
Still playing for the Rams.
They played the Saints. They lost to the Cardinals one year, so I got off them. And then they went to St. Louis, whatever, and then they went back to L.A., so I still like them. And then the quarterback was Jared Goff's son.
Jared Goff's son.
An old roommate of mine, and he was... He was replaced by Joe Siddle in Montreal.
See, I remember Jerry Goff when he played for the Expos because I was covering them, and Buck Rogers couldn't pronounce his name. It always came out Jerry Goff. And Griffin and I still laugh about this. Richard Griffin was the PR director for the Expos then, and we still laugh about it because guys would intentionally ask Buck questions about him just to hear him mispronounce the name Jerry Goff. Yeah, I forgot. And that's right. Siddle did replace.
Oh, yeah. That was a story. And I don't think Siddle remembers that he replaced Jerry Goff, but Jerry Goff definitely remembers that Siddle replaced him.
He was a big dude, too, wasn't he?
Why? Yeah, he was a good-looking man. So he was.
You're a Rams fan.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm a Vikings fan, so we've got, I don't know how much there is in common. Just a shared history of grief. Well, you do have a Super Bowl.
Well, yeah. I'm looking at you and Arash.
Yeah, well, Arash
he's a tortured Viking fan.
Yeah, I'm old enough. I remember them going to the Super Bowls and losing. That's when I was living in Winnipeg, and I mean, we got a steady diet of Vikings football back then because it was the closest team. But I'm not as warped about it as Arash is.
Yeah.
I've made peace with my Viking fandom.
And when I was a kid, it was Fran Tarkington.
Yeah.
And Ron Yeary. Do you remember Ron Yeary?
Ron Yeary
started
USC,
a photography.
USC, right? Yes. Was he a USC dude?
Yep. Yeah. Started a photography company. So all of my little league photos, high school photos, of team photos, all came from Yeary photography.
Ron Yeary. Wow.
Good player.
Great offensive lineman for the Minnesota Vikings. So anyhow, the reason that I threw the NFL out there is that John Clayton, host on 710 ESPN Seattle, and NFL analyst and also host of the Schooled with the Professor podcast will join us at 3:00. We'll get you set for the weekend ahead in the NFL. Take a look back at what happened last night. The world, I know this is going to annoy some people, but the world does feel a little better when the Dallas Cowboys are in crisis, doesn't it? Doesn't the sun just seem to shine a little brighter when Dallas is in crisis?
I think so. I lived there for a few years, and yeah, I enjoy when they struggle a little bit. And like, they're still in first place though.
Let me ask you this. Crazier city about its team, Leafs in Toronto or Cowboys in Dallas?
Such a different feel. The Texas is so, like, you know that saying, everything's big in Texas? Like, it is. Like, the stadium's like mammoth. Everything's big. Everything takes on a whole nother life. People really, really live and die their sports. So they really, really live and die the Cowboys. And I know people really live and die the Leafs here, too. Mm-hmm. But, like, Texas is a whole nother animal.
John Clayton of 710 ESPN Seattle and the Schooled with the Professor podcast will join us. We'll talk a little NFL ahead of the weekend. Joey Vitale, radio analyst with the St. Louis Blues, will be along as well. All that ahead in Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Tim Leeper at Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio.
You're simply the best.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch.
Better than all the rest.
On on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360. A reminder that we have your chance to win a trip, including hotel accommodations, to see both Toronto teams back-to-back in April and get admission to the Hockey Hall of Fame with our VTech Wake-Up Call contest. You can also win a $500 prize pack every week. Give us a call at 416-413-4141. Leave us your best Toronto sports opinion. Set your alarms for 8:20 a.m. every Friday morning for the VTech Wake-Up Call and lead off with Ashley Ziggy and Scotty Mack. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for more details. Big weekend ahead in the NFL. San Francisco, New Orleans, big game locally. I guess I can call this locally. The Baltimore Ravens and Lamar Jackson against the Buffalo Bills, I'm going to say the greatest show in turf, although that's already been used. The Bills 9-3, Baltimore 10-2. Lamar Jackson has taken care of the best teams in the NFL. It'll be fascinating to see what a very good Buffalo Bills defense does to Lamar Jackson.
This is really one to look forward to because Baltimore is an offensive juggernaut.
They're so much fun. And the interesting aspect here, of course, there's several interesting aspects. One of them is Buffalo has a running quarterback of their own in Josh Allen. So it's going to be an interesting head-to-head meeting. John Clayton is host on 710 ESPN Seattle. He's NFL analyst. He's also host of the School to the Professor podcast. John Clayton joins Tim Leeper and myself in Writer's Block. John, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Before we look ahead to the weekend, let's look back last night. We've talked about, I think every time we have you on, we talk about the Cowboys, and we've kind of charted the Cowboys' descent, if you want to call it that. I got to ask you this right now. What do you think is the problem? Is there one problem with that team right now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy the idea, like some of the people down in Dallas, that the team quit on Jason Garrett, but I think that you can see there's a disconnect there because there's too much talent for the performance that they had. I mean, you see them come out, they drive, they get the 17-play drive for the touchdown, take the 7-0 lead, and you say, just like a Thanksgiving, it's like, hey, Cowboys are back. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, their offense gets off the script. They tend to get away from the running game and go a little bit too much passing. The defense doesn't make plays. I mean, they went for over 230 plays, I think, over several games stretch where they didn't force a turnover. And how can you have guys like DeMarcus Lawrence, the linebackers that they have, the cornerbacks they have, and not get turnovers? And so there's just something off on that team that's, you know, it's like the talent's there, but the performance isn't there. And that means ultimately, you know, unless he wins two games in the playoffs, which he won't, Jason Garrett's gone.
Wow. When you talk about, you know, the conventional wisdom in Dallas, Deitch and I talked about this a little bit. I understand that unlike a lot of owners, Jerry Jones understands football. I get all that. But, John, at some point, isn't Jerry Jones as much of a problem here?
You would think so, but of course...
But he can't do anything. Yeah, you can't fire the owner. I get that, but...
No, you can't fire the owner, and he's the general manager, and so you can't do anything there. But the problem they face is that, he can get the talent. He can take care of the talent, and he did. I mean, you look at their last few drafts. They've been really, really good, but it's just not meshing on the field. I mean, and I don't know why. I mean, last year they went to the playoffs, looked like they were on the rise. They beat the Seahawks. They advance to the second round and lose. But then where Jerry has to take some blame is that, remember, this is now 25 years without going to the Super Bowl. And the last time that he went, you know, basically he made the mistake of firing Jimmy Johnson. You know, Barry Switzer, who had such a talented team that he was able to win one Super Bowl, but that was it. And then everything kind of crumbled after that. You know, sometimes it just seems that, you know, he knows football, but he's not a general manager. And they get themselves in problems. And, he's the one who wanted Ezekiel Elliott, and he was right on that. You know, he had to be kind of talked into Dak Prescott. Remember, Jerry is forcing the issue that he wanted to get Johnny Manziel.
That's right.
So So there, you know, sometimes he makes mistakes like that, but, you know, he cares about the team. He's willing to pay the players. He better take care of Dak Prescott, which I'm sure he will. But, you know, it just seems that, you know, he wanted a coach that doesn't want to fight him in personnel. Jason's not going to fight him on the personnel because it's nice, because he'll do anything that Jerry wants. But now it's just not working.
Do you think any less or any, I'll rephrase that. Do you think any differently, John, about Dak Prescott now than you may have at the end of last season or the start of this season?
No, I think really he's better. I mean, because you think about the problems they've had on offense the last couple of years. Some of it's been him holding the ball too long, but then some of that back 2 years ago had to do with what they had at wide receiver. You know, Dez Bryant lost his speed because of the two metatarsal injuries in his feet, and so now he couldn't run as well, and they had receivers that couldn't get any separation from the cornerbacks. And so now here's Dak holding the ball too long because nobody's open. And so they fixed that, and you notice as soon as they got Amari Cooper, that was the spark that got them into the playoffs last year, because he came there as a great route runner, opened things up, and you know, got them moving on offense. And then this year, you know, they get off to the 3-0 start against, you know, three puffies. I mean, three of the worst teams in the league. And then since then, you know, they've won only three games, and they've not beaten a winning team.
The Buffalo Bills are going to get a pretty intriguing test, to say the least, this weekend against Baltimore. Josh Allen might give the Ravens a bit of a test as well. What about Buffalo's defense, John, suggest to you, or does anything about Buffalo's defense suggest to you that this, you know, this game may be as difficult for Lamar as San Francisco or New England?
Well, I mean, I think the weather conditions are going to play a part, and that may help out the Bills just from the standpoint of the snows and the weather's going to be bad. I guess it's not like, you know, Lamar has not necessarily played like in games like this, but it'd be one of his first games in being able to go on the snow and all that stuff. So we'll see where the weather takes it. But no, I think that, you know, Sean McDermott has a defense that doesn't give up a lot of points. But what I'm wondering is that, you know, can Josh generate enough offense to be able to outscore Lamar? Lamar is just remarkable so far, but if the footing's going to be a little bit off, that could help the Bills. So there's a little bit of an advantage there, and that's why I think it's going to be a great game.
What separates those two running quarterbacks still?
Lamar, I've never seen a quarterback who can run like that, never. And what also is good is that how quickly he's advanced as a pocket passer. Because now he's got the combination of both. I mean, he can beat you with his feet, and he can just stand there in the pocket and get rid of the ball quickly and accurately and move it downfield. That's amazing to think what he's able to do there. And I never thought they would have that kind of advancement over the course of a year. Because remember, I mean, this is a guy that was pretty much a 55% thrower, and all of a sudden he gets hot. Josh is getting better and better and better. I think you can see his personality starting to emerge. He's showing the energy. He's showing the excitement. He's getting better as a quarterback. I mean, you know, to a point, and this is where you can make the argument, you know, where everybody was, you know, Sam Darnold and Baker Mayfield and all that stuff in last year's draft. As it's turning out right now, you know, both Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen right now are the better of the four.
The 10-2 Saints are going to take on the 10-2 49ers Sunday at 1 o'clock. I mean, you look at this matchup, and it seems in a lot of ways, you know, you've got the number two rushing offense in San Francisco against the number three rush defense in New Orleans. There's a lot of teams that seem to have weaknesses where the other team has a strength, or strength, I guess more accurately, John, strengths where the other teams, where the other team has a strength. What do you think this game comes down to?
I think it comes down to the Saints' ability to stop the 49ers' run and get pressure on Jimmy Garoppolo. Because the one thing that you've seen, as great as Jimmy has been, and he's had a great year, is that if you can take away the run, and as you mentioned, the Saints are very good at taking away the run, that if Cameron Jordan and some of the pass rushers can get in there and put pressure, Garoppolo makes mistakes where you don't see Drew Brees making mistakes. And so if he makes a mistake and a turnover or two, that'll be the difference in the game. And so the key for the 49ers is to be able to run the football and get that going, because if they can't do it, it puts everything on Garoppolo, and that's where they could struggle.
You know, one team that at the start of the year I was slightly intrigued in was the L.A. Chargers. You know, I have a bit of a soft spot for the Chargers going back to when they were in San Diego for part of the reason. But look, it looks like Philip Rivers' time is coming to an end. What do the Chargers have to do, John, to get back on the right path here? And should there be a concern in the NFL here, given what's going on in that marketplace right now?
Oh, big concern about the marketplace. I mean, that right now is looking really bad because, I mean, you can see that the Chargers are having trouble selling PSLs. They're having trouble generating any kind of crowd and generating any buzz. And this is after a 12-win season with Philip Rivers. I mean, you would think that, okay, they're going to jump on board, but L.A. is a town that it takes a couple of years to jump on board. And you already got the relationship being strained between the Rams and the Chargers in the sense that the Chargers – the worry that there is they're not going to be able to draw well. And at some point, if they don't and you have so many empty seats, then you may have to have the league start to look at it and say, hey, we got to figure something out here, because it's a $5 billion stadium. And even here's L.A., L.A. And the Rams, they've kind of bought into them, but not totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like what you're seeing down with the Clippers. I mean, the Clippers are trying to reestablish themselves in the market. It's taking some time, but they're making some progress, but almost more progress than the Rams, even though they went to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's strange because, one of the – and I could never – look, I don't understand all the intricacies of what happened with the Chargers and their stadium issue in San Diego. I know a little bit about how the Padres got their stadium built, and, I mean, there were a lot of hoops they had to jump through. But, John, to me, it made sense to have a team in that part of California and try to turn it into a regional team. I understand it's not that far from LA. I get all that, but it's always struck me that there had to be a way to make that work in San Diego. There just had to be because it was in its own ways, it was a loyal fan base.
Oh, I agree. And the problem was not the fan base. The problem was the politicians. And, it got to the point where, if you're Alex or you're Dean Spanos, now you have to make a business decision, which right now may not be, financial, I guess it's still going to be good because there's enough money with the revenues and everything else, but, it's still not looking good, but he couldn't get them to move whatsoever. And so now the possibility was that the Raiders would have taken the spot down in LA and they didn't want that to happen. And so they grabbed it. And right now it's looking like a bad reach.
John, we're going to let you run. Appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Clayton, 710 ESPN Seattle. He's also host of the Schooled with the Professor podcast. And Tim, again, you were an LA Rams fan, an Orange County kid. Tell me a little bit about the geographics of that area, because it's the same thing. The Angels are in Orange County, and the Angels and the Dodgers and the Padres. I mean, those are three teams. That's a pretty easy drive to get from those three stadiums if you aren't well. Distance-wise, it can be an awful drive in terms of traffic. Let me rephrase it. But is there that much difference geographically between downtown LA, Orange County, and San Diego?
Growing up there, and that you asked that, yeah, it seems like there is. And each team has its own little niche. I mean, the Dodger fans are way different than the Angel fans. I think the Angel fans, with their success early in the 2000s, that changed a little bit. It's more of like a little bit of a white collar crowd, mm-hmm. I think, there than in a Dodger Stadium, where the old Dodger fans are like great. They go back to obviously to the mid 60s when the Angels came there at the same time, but it's definitely a different feel. I just remember growing up there, like San Diego seemed like a whole nother world. And that now that you drive it, and you can literally drive it in an hour with no traffic, which actually never happens. But seemed like San Diego was its own little entity, and it seemed really far removed. So I think geographically, and especially with the Dodgers, Angels, and at the time, maybe now with the Ducks mm-hmm. and the Kings, like they're different fan bases, and it's such a big area where I think they actually have their own fans and their own little niche. And I agree with you with San Diego. I think there's a way to make it work there because there's enough diehard fans. And again, like if you can't get the stadium built and then you have bad ownership, then it becomes a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, they tried to tap into the Mexico market. I mean, I can remember being down there when I was covering baseball, and you'd be reading the papers, and I'm going back to like 1990, 1991. There were always stories about the Chargers, but even when the Chargers had Dan Fouts and they were good, there's always stories about them kind of being in trouble because the money just wasn't working in San Diego. And I could never wrap my head around that because, as you said, it just seemed to me that even though it was close geographically, there's, you got San Diego, you got Chargers fans, you got Dodgers fans, you got Angels fans, And all you have to do is go watch a Padres-Dodgers game to know they hate each other.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's for two areas that are really close together, it's remarkable how different the crowds are.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, even from L.A. County to Orange County, it's a totally different. It's totally different.
Why do you think football's had such a difficult time in L.A.? You know, such a checkered past, certainly after the Rams left. I've always thought L.A., Tim, has kind of been, it's almost been like the, it's almost what St. Pete used to be in baseball. It's kind of if your team's in trouble, threaten to move to L.A. You know, if you can't get a stadium deal done, talk about moving to L.A. But what happened to the NFL's hold on L.A.?
I don't know. I don't really know, but I think when the Rams left the first time, when they left the Coliseum, I thought that was a big thing. I think taking it out of L.A. like they did, and I don't know how many years elapsed there was between the Raiders, before the Raiders came in.
Right.
But I think that damaged it a little bit because I don't think Orange County was as big a football community as L.A. was. I think that the original Rams in the Coliseum, I think that was a natural fit. It was a great draw, you know, just for TV. Mm-hmm. They had great players, Roman Gabriel, you go back. There were some great players there.
Matt Hayden had great years there.
Yeah, when they went to the
John
Super
Bowl. John Cappelletti.
It started to sour when Dieter Brock came. Dieter Brock wasn't a great, but he was great in Edmonton, right?
Dieter, don't go blaming the CFL star. It was true.
Ben Ferragamo was good.
Ferragamo was good. Then he came up to Montreal and he wasn't any good. So that was the trade, Ferragamo for Dieter Brock. But yeah, no.
The landscape changed when they moved to Orange County, for sure.
Yeah, it seemed really, like I said, you look at LA and you'd go, every team has to be successful there. It would make sense that it would. But as you know, as John said, the Clippers have taken a while to establish themselves. Now I understand the Lakers are, you know, the Lakers are like a Cadillac franchise. But man, I've always looked at LA and thought every team should be able to be successful there. But I just don't see it working with the Chargers. I really don't.
Yeah, and it's that one team that doesn't get a foothold, kind of like the Rays. I mean, there's no place for them to go, and when they go there, and the Rams to an extent, like you hit it too. Like they went to the Super Bowl last year, and you don't see the support like you would think you would see from a Super Bowl team.
No.
With a young, exciting team too.
No, it's strange. I mean, you'd think they'd capture the imagination of the place a little more than they did. The Maple Leafs are off to St. Louis. They worked out today here in Toronto. They're off to St. Louis. They'll play the Blues tomorrow night. Hockey Night in Canada's pregame starts at 6:30. Puck drop just after 7. Leafs Nation postgame with Al Berg and Stellick right after the final horn on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Lots of drama around the Toronto Maple Leafs, of course. Not so much with the St. Louis Blues. It does not appear to be a championship hangover on the part of the St. Louis Blues. Joey Vitale is a Blues radio analyst. He'll join us next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet 360. The Toronto Maple Leafs take on the St. Louis Blues Saturday in St. Louis. Of course, the Blues defending Stanley Cup champions there, 18-6-6. The Leafs, 13-13-4. Pick your crisis with the Leafs. Auston Matthews has stopped scoring. They don't have a backup goaltender. They have given up 9 goals in their last 2 games, a 3-1 loss to Colorado, mind you, that was a slightly different attitude and atmosphere around that game than they lost to the Philadelphia Flyers. But nonetheless, it hasn't taken very long for the focus to come off all the new stuff Sheldon Keefe is doing. And he has done just about everything you can conceivably do as a head coach with his lineup. And with his goaltenders, I mean, he's literally throwing the kitchen sink out there. I think the attention, Tim's kind of come off him, and it's really squarely on the players now, because I think the understanding is, you know, there's no major change happening to this lineup that's going to be optimistic. In other words, if this thing keeps going south, the only thing we're going to see is a team that might start offloading some guys and looking quietly ahead to next year.
Yeah, you look at my big question just as a fan is like, are they good enough? I mean, it's a team that had two chances to beat Boston last year and get to the next round. And if they go there, who knows? They could end up in the final very easily. Yeah. So is this team a lot like last year's team? I know. And it was easy to like jump on Kadri last year, and he took the suspension at the wrong time and did the wrong things. But like when you watch what's going on, you see what happens. Like it's kind of like, don't you want that kind of guy back?
I guarantee you that more than once on Wednesday night, fans who were watching that game on TV, and Nazem Kadri didn't have a great game, but fans who were watching that game on TV, and you know those of us sitting in the press box, the thought did go through our mind. Boy, this team could really use a little Nazem Kadri right now. You know, like that would be the type of game, second half of a back-to-back, coach has kind of called out the team, starting goaltender has gone to the coach and said, I want to start both games here. I want the guys to rally behind me. That's the type of game where Nazem Kadri probably would have come out and hit somebody last year. And essentially the Leafs did their version of throwing a no-hitter. But it is true, and it's a valid question. I ask myself this now. We've just kind of assumed that this team has so much talent and is so good that it was just a matter of getting the coaching straightened out. And I admit I'm one of those people that thought Mike Babcock the end of last year. I thought Kyle Dubas would have been absolutely justified in moving him. But in addition to all that, Tim, the other thing that's happened, and this really hasn't helped, I don't think, the attitude of Leafs fans, the Bruins are just so good.
They won't go away. They just continue to be good.
The Bruins have the gap between Boston and Toronto, I would argue right now, between the Bruins and Toronto, looks wider than it has at any point since Auston Matthews was with this team, since the rebuild started. I mean, it just looks huge.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, like, looking at the Leafs right now, like once the coaching change happened, you can tell they're a tight group. You can tell they get along. And there's genuine, like and love for each other and concern. And that's what concerns me about the way they're playing right now, because like those things seem to be fixed. Now, like, again, it comes down to the question, like, God, are they good enough? Are they balanced enough? It's hard to win a cup without having great role players. And like, someone's going to have to step up in that role. And obviously just the physicality and being able to stick up for one another and have the grit that you need. And here we are playing St. Louis, a team that's got tons of grit and really kind of goes back to like good old honest hockey, right? Like when you're going to watch this matchup, you know, against these two teams, you're looking at two completely different teams. One that just won a Stanley Cup.
The Leafs will start their 4-game road trip tomorrow night in St. Louis against the Blues. As we mentioned, Joey Vitale is the St. Louis Blues radio analyst. He joins Tim Leeper and myself on Writer's Block. Joey, thanks so much for joining us today. So what happened to the championship hangover? It does not appear to have set in St. Louis.
Well, Jeff, Tim, good afternoon. Hey, thanks for having me on. You know what, guys? It's one of those weird things that, you know, Doug Armstrong talked about, you know, heading into this season. You know, he was part of the Dallas Stars team that won a cup. And then you have Craig Berube that was a part of the Stanley Cup championship with Philadelphia as well. And these both coaches have come off seasons where they've gone the distance. And they both commented saying that, you know, October was typically a month where you're still feeding off last year's energy and typically you have a lot of success. But really it's in the month of November that you really see a hangover. But to your question right there, there really hasn't been a hangover. The month of November was spectacular for the St. Louis Blues. A lot of road games, and they win a lot of them on the road. And even when they came home, they took care of business. An incredible month of November. You know, an interesting stat from November 2nd, I think, to December 5th, when we were in Pittsburgh the other night, it was a 33-day period, to give you an idea of how crazy November was for the Blues. 33 days between that time frame, and the Blues were on the road or had a home game for 27 out of the 33 days. So to put that in perspective, the Blues, six days out of 33 of those days, they were home on a day off or a practice day. That kind of gives you an idea of the magnitude of the travel and the demanding schedule November was. But they just went out there, and like you were just mentioning about the Boston Bruins. To me, that's the team in the Western Conference that mimics the Boston Bruins, that they just do not want to go away, and they continue to find ways to win every single night.
What do you factor in for the fact that you guys are such a good road team?
You know, I think that, you know, Craig Berube has instilled in this group that, you know, when he took over about a year ago, but one of the differences he made right away to this team was, we're going to start playing hard. We're going to practice hard. We're going to have better practice habits, and we're going to work. We're going to be aggressive. He instilled that right away. Now, we've seen this throughout the NHL where coaches try to do that. It works when you start to win. And then Jordan Binnington comes in, starts getting the saves. So the winning became contagious. So now this is how this team plays. They play aggressive and they play very fast. And that is all about road hockey. I mean, as we know, as we see in the National Hockey League, the more simple you keep it, especially on the road, the more success you're going to have. This is a team that knows there's one way to win, and it's playing simple and aggressive. You know, they look at the Toronto Maple Leafs, for example. The Toronto Maple Leafs have the luxury to some nights sit back, play bad, but you have your talent take over. I played many years in Pittsburgh. I remember being on that bench where the team as a whole, we were a bit of a dud. We were sleepy. We weren't aggressive, but we had Sidney Crosby and Kenny Malkin, and they go out there and just do their thing, and we win games 4-2, and everything's okay. This Blues team is not like that. They know that in order to win, they got to defend hard and they got to be aggressive. They got to forecheck. They got to do all those nuts and bolts to why it's effective for them, you know, to win hockey games. So they go on the road and they just continue to do it. They have just this complete buy-in. You guys mentioned the Toronto Maple Leafs as a group that gets along now. The St. Louis Blues, being around these guys for the last year, traveling with them on the plane, a tight group. They really care about each other. They're pulling for each other. Even through the injuries, they're getting call-ups, and everyone's just kind of grouping together. It's a next-man-up mentality, and it's an all-in mindset. And this is a group that just continues to hum along. And as Craig Berube just continues to put out a hard work at that kind of style of hockey, the players have bought in, and they just keep rolling.
Can you talk a little bit about Jake Allen was the head goaltender. He's accepted his role as the backup well, and now he's really starting to flourish again. And you got one of the obviously a great goalie tandem. Talk about his buy-in and what that means to everybody as well.
Well, you know, last year was a humbling process for Jake, and this happens in the National Hockey League, you know, at least once or twice a year where you have a starting goaltender, he goes through a little bit of a dry spell, a younger kid comes up and takes his job, and that's what happened last year. Jordan Binnington came in up from the minors, and because of a couple of injuries, he got an opportunity, he takes over, he wins a cup. Not a fun situation for Jake, even though he won a Stanley Cup, but on his pride is on the line, his ego takes a hit. But, you know, throughout that playoff stretch, you know, there's been some stories about it. I'm sure you guys have seen it. Anyone out there, all the listeners who haven't heard about it, you know, Jake Allen, talk about a complete buy-in team guy. Throughout the playoff stretch, at the end of practice, he actually would mimic the goaltenders they were facing in playoffs. He would mimic Hellebuck style towards the end so players can kind of have an idea of where his weaknesses were. The last round, Tuukka Rask, he was doing certain things with his glove that Tuukka did that not necessarily were beneficial to Jake or didn't really help his game at all, but it was helping the guys in front of him. So Jake Allen's that type of personality. He's been here 10 years. Guys absolutely love him. And not only that, not only is he a good locker room backup guy, but he is winning some games. I mean, the game he had in Chicago the other night, 40 save shutout, he's kind of starting to look like Jake Allen of his prime. I think that when you look at the 1-2 tandems, the National Hockey League with Tuukka Rask and Halak, whether it's Hudobin and Bishop, and now Jake Allen and Jordan Binnington, they kind of had that common thread where if one goalie's going good, then it kind of pushes the other one to go because they kind of push each other in practice. I think there's some healthy competition. I don't think that Jordan Binnington by any right thinks it's his net. He's earned it. He's going to put the rest of the year. I think it's anyone's net to always lose. And that's the goaltender position, unfortunately, for those guys. So they always got to be, you know, dialed in. They always got to be performing and they always got to be winning games and having good percentages and keeping their teams in the position to win because, you know, as soon as you slip up, you got someone nipping in your heels right behind you. So that healthy competition between Jake and Jordan Binnington has really pushed this duo along.
Joey Vitale is the St. Louis Blues radio analyst. He joins Tim Leeper and myself in Writer's Block. Justin Falk's numbers from a distance aren't gaudy, but you know, you talked about sort of the championship hangover, and I brought that up. And one of the things that I'm a big believer in, and you know, you talk to people who put together championship teams, they'll tell you that it's not always a bad thing to bring a new personality into a team that's just won a championship. You know, the Toronto Blue Jays did that when they won back-to-back championships. So just create a little churn, freshen things up a bit. What impact has Justin had on this team in that regard?
Well, you know, I agree with that completely. You know, I didn't think about it too much before the season started. There was really no pieces that needed to be brought in because Doug Armstrong pretty much had the exact same group heading into the season. I mean, yes, you lose Pat Maroon, but that was really about it, because keep in mind, Joe Edmondson had been traded for Justin Falk at that moment. But, you know, you bring in a new player, and I think that we're starting to see that some fresh blood really is good. Kind of spices it up. It keeps things kind of rolling. And even to some degree, I think with all the Blues injuries that we've seen, with Tarasenko's down, Alexander Steen's out, Sammy Blaze down for a while, now Oscar Sundquist, what we're starting to see is we're seeing these call-ups. We're seeing the Nathan Walkers. We're seeing the Klim Kostins. We're seeing young guys come up and kind of bring energy. And it was one of those things where, and I'm getting a little sidetracked here for a second, but if you hang with me, a lot of these Blues players, and you talk about the hangover, that style that the Blues require to win, that aggressive, hard style, well, it requires a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. And I think if they stayed completely healthy, if you don't lose Tarasenko and Steen, I don't know if the Blues have this record they have right now. I think they're going to lose a lot more games because you have older guys that are worn down from the Stanley Cup final. But you do have those injuries, and you do have young guys getting called up so they can keep producing more and more high intense energy for the style that it requires of this team to win. So I almost think the injuries have kind of helped in the sense because you have that new blood. Now, Justin Falk's numbers certainly are not where he wants them, not where this team, I think, expected them to be at this point. But that's just from an offensive standpoint. You ask Craig Berube about Justin Falk, and he's very high on him. He talks about his defensive play. He talks about his ability to poke pucks, just move the puck north. I mean, guys, we've seen this in the National Hockey League so often. Just a defenseman that can make tape-to-tape passes and move the pucks efficiently, a key type. I mean, those players have a long time in this league, and any forward loves looking back and seeing Justin Falk back there because they know they're going to get the puck on the stick. So he's doing a lot of things aside from the offensive numbers that Craig Berube really thrives in and loves. Now, to be realistic, he goes from maybe a 1-2 defenseman in Carolina eating up 25 minutes a night. Now he's joining, I'm not just saying this because I'm biased, but I believe the best defensive core in the National Hockey League in the St. Louis Blues. And that's what even Travis Green said on our last road trip. You know, he said the Blues were probably the top defensive core in the National Hockey League. And I agree. So Justin Falk comes to this, and now he's a 5-6 guy, maybe some nights, maybe he's just eating 17, 18 minutes up. And you guys know, we talked to a lot of players all the time. When you're a player that goes from, you know, playing 25 minutes and you get dropped down to 18, it's not just 6-7 minutes you're losing. It's a rhythm. It's a routine that you kind of have to get used to. So I think Justin Falk has a little bit of growing pains. I think he's starting to learn how to play those minutes more effectively. But again, it takes time. It takes time for him to be in that 5-6 hole. And from the head coaching standpoint, he's been very positive, and he's really liked what he's seen from Justin Falk.
As you move forward here, and all those points right there, I totally agree with. And having, when you have injuries and it gives so many chances to step up, and it also creates depths and different ways to win. But as you move forward, like, how important is Tarasenko in coming back in regards to winning a Stanley Cup again?
Well, I think it's important. You know, the timeline, the last we've kind of heard was around March. They were predicting, hopefully in March, that would be the 5-month mark where they're looking at. Now, whether they're just saying that, or, I mean, who knows what the reality is. I mean, this is a team that's going to invest in his health for the long term because of what he means to this team over a franchise and over a whole maybe career. So they're not going to rush him. That's the first thing. But if he recovers well and he's ready to go in March, it's going to be huge. I mean, he's going to be rested. He's going to be fresh. He's going to be hungry. And he's going to be coming in right around playoff time if the Blues can kind of hold on here and keep in that playoff hunt, which, of course, they are right now. Vladimir Tarasenko, of course, the proven scorer. He's just precise around the net. He's incredible in the power play. No one on this team shoots like him. And he's just a big body that draws eyes from defenders. You know, when you're playing with a Vladimir Tarasenko, when you're playing with an Austin Matthews, it creates space for everyone because defenders just keep an eye on him. They give him more space. You're weary. You're cognizant of him on the ice, and that opens up areas for everyone else. Vladimir has been a great leader for this group. He was a machine throughout the playoffs. He's a proven winner, and he's a gamer. He wants to get on the ice, and no one is as hungry for the puck and is as frustrated when he doesn't get it as Vladdy, almost to the point sometimes where it could be a little hard to see his teammate, I think, but that just speaks to the hunger and how this guy just wants to win. He wants the puck on the stick when the game's on the line, and those are the players you need come playoff time. Those are the guys that are going to dig down deep and are going to play with just that absolute grit. When the game is on the line, he can fight through checks. So getting him back before the playoffs would be huge. I know we're a long way off from that, and a lot just has to do with his rehab and how he recovers. But it's something to definitely keep an eye on as the season kind of comes at the halfway point and we continue to that playoff area.
You know, one of the things that is obvious this year, one of the performances, I think, Joey, and I'm thinking you'd agree with me. One of the guys who's really stepped up in all that is Braden Schenn. I mean, I'm looking at his numbers. He's got 14 goals. You know, his season high is, or his single season high is 28 in 2017, 2008. He's got 14 goals in 30 games so far. He would appear to have really stepped up his game with the injuries.
Yeah, he has. And, you know, one of the thing guys that, you know, his points, he's not getting a ton of opportunities. I think the last I checked, his attempts per goals were near the top. I think he was like ranked fourth or fifth. So for as little as he shoots the puck, he's actually putting a lot in the back of the net. And he's kind of got that sneaky shot. He doesn't release it high all that often. He kind of keeps pucks on the ice, which is kind of different. It kind of catches goalies off guard a lot. Watch him go five hole quite a bit. So instead of players, you know, coming down, going low blocker, or maybe going upstairs around the goaltender's ears, Braden kind of catches them off guard with just kind of sliding something through the five hole nice and hard right on the ice. But he's been an effective shooter since, you know, Vladimir Tarasenko, especially since he's gone down with injury. And it hasn't been easy for Braden because he's had a multitude of different wingers. He had Tyler Bozak for a while, Robert Thomas. He's out with Nathan Walker, who a lot of people probably don't even know in the National Hockey League right now because he's only played maybe 10, 15 games between the Capitals and now the Blues, a call-up from the American Hockey League. So a lot of different wingers, but he is a top-line center for Craig Berube. He is the epitome of what Craig Berube speaks about and what he loves about the game of hockey. I can't think of a better centerman, the top guy for Craig Berube than Braden Schenn. He had him in Philadelphia, and when you play for the coach the way Braden does, you're going to earn the trust of the coach. You're going to get out there in all kinds of situations. And I know the numbers are great, but, you know, he just plays with such physicality. You know, he's like a piece of just metal. He doesn't ever get hurt, knock on wood. He forechecks. He backchecks. He kills penalties. He's great on the power play. He looks poised. And, you know, he's just a student of the game. You know, Darren Pang and I just love talking to him after morning skates and on practice days or off days, or we catch him in the coffee shop on the road. And he's never a guy that just talks about fluff. He doesn't talk about the weather in Toronto if we're in Toronto. He doesn't talk about random things about movies or news. He talks about the game. He talks about players. He loves the ins and outs, the nuts and bolts of the game, contract extensions, who's going to go where, what did you think about this play? And he is just someone who just, you can tell he loves the game, and you can tell because, you know, the way he plays, and he plays with that consistency. He's been a go-to guy this year for the Blues, and I know the Blues would not be in the position they are right now without a few things, and Braden Schenn's definitely one of those top reasons.
Hey, Joey, we appreciate you joining us, man. Thanks so much.
Jeff, Tim, anytime, guys. You guys have a great day. Stay warm.
You too. Take care. It's Joey Vitale, St. Louis Blues radio analyst. If Braden Schenn is that keen to talk hockey, he could have a future in the media business. The Leafs and Blues tomorrow night, Hockey Night in Canada, 7 o'clock puck drop, 6:30 pregame. Leafs Nation postgame with L. Berg and Stellick after the final horn on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. It's interesting, you know, when you talk about guys, Tim, guys who come up and step up, guys from the farm team. I've always thought that one of the things, if you're a guy and you are joining the St. Louis Blues, if you're part of their farm system or their AHL team, you step up and you're joining that team, you know, that team is good enough that it would seem to me it would almost be one of those positions where all you have to do is really work hard and you're going to have success because there's enough guys around there that are going to take care of you. It's got to be kind of fun to join a team that's a defending champion. You just have to go and work hard.
Yeah, and it's great when it's like that. I mean, obviously, with the Blue Jays, we were here like that. After 15, it just drove you to be even better. And actually, when you get that win, it drives you to want to hang on. And I think a lot of that comes from their coach. I mean, their coach is the guy. I mean, they didn't make a whole lot of changes other than obviously Bennington standing on his head and having a great goalie tandem. And they brought in O'Reilly, I believe, who was really good and solidified a lot of things for him. But like, you go in, you work hard. The coach is preaching that if you work hard, good things are going to happen. I just think it sets a really healthy tone. And talking to Joey right there too, you realize like how really healthy they are. They're like, those are really good. There's no really problems, but they have good issues. You know,
well, they have
a ton
good
of
issues.
Injuries, but
I mean, you know, here's the thing: you've got a lot of injuries, but you're 18-6-6, and if you're the Blues, you can afford to look at this and go, you know what, this actually might be a positive. Look, you'd rather have a healthy Vladimir Tarasenko. But if you can keep body and soul together, you're the top team in the Western Conference. If you can get into March and you're 1-2-3 and you're getting arrested, you're getting these guys back and they're rested.
So much of this is peaking at the right time. And I think the Raptors are going through it right now as well. And I think that's a great thing because you're getting other guys to step. They're going through exactly the same thing because you got guys that can step up and get big minutes that they wouldn't be afforded to get otherwise. And You got to be fresh going in the hockey. You got to be fresh going to the playoffs. If you grind it out through the season, that makes it that much tougher.
Yeah, and I really do believe this. And Brian Cashman used to talk about it all the time. It's not bad to change over guys in a championship team. It's not bad to bring new blood in to a championship team.
We talked off the air. Like, we never talk about the 92 Blue Jays. And
no,
it was the first World Series in Canada.
Yeah,
they totally overhauled that team in the offseason.
And think about what that, if you did that now, what would happen?
Oh, you'd be getting killed on this thing right
now.
Oh,
my God. Could you imagine?
What's Pat doing?
Exactly. He's taking apart the World Series champions. We'll take a break and come back. It's Tim Leeper, Jeff Blair, Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, of Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want
all right, welcome back to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Tim Leeper. A little bit of breaking news here. David Fizdale, this is so unpredictable, has been fired by head coach of the New York Knicks. So there you go, David Fizdale gone. From Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. No update as far as I have seen regarding a replacement. Poor David Fizdale. I mean, we could have a long discussion about which franchise is the most messed up in sports. But when you start talking about the amount of money involved and the potential for that franchise, can you imagine if the New York Knicks were good?
Oh,
it's just, they seem so far away now. It's too bad because, I mean, I know Travis McKenzie, my producer, used to report at Raptors games. And we agree. Like, David Fizdale is one of our favorite visiting coaches to talk to. And a lot of people around the NBA will say the same thing. They love the guy. And, I mean, he was a guy that LeBron was really close to, right?
Yeah, he was the lead assistant of those Miami teams.
That's right. LeBron was really close to him. And a lot of people think that one of the reasons he stayed in the game was LeBron kept getting him jobs. But anyhow, there you go. So RJ Barrett, his first year with the New York Knicks, learned one of the harsh lessons of being a professional athlete. Wake up one morning, your coach is fired. Oof. Can you imagine being a rookie and you're, 30 games into your career? You've had your first coach fired? that wouldn't go over well with me.
I don't know. You feel responsible a little bit. It's really bad if you like the guy.
Yeah, and that's the thing. With no indication as to the team's just god awful. But I don't know who would have been able to turn.
Who would be your most dysfunctional team in sports? The Mets are going to change right now. So
they're the Mets though. I mean, I'm just thinking of North America. I'll tell you what. I think the Dallas Cowboys are awfully close, just because you've got all that talent and you're not doing anything with it. The Ottawa Senators, Travis McKenzie. Yeah. And that's, generally the most dysfunctional team is when you're talking about dysfunction at ownership. That's when it's really dysfunctional. All the other stuff can be cured by a guy being fired or a guy being moved or a trade.
Yep.
Your dysfunction in the ownership level.
There's not
a whole hell of a lot. Hell of a lot anybody can do when that's the case. That's for sure. Ren Lavoie, he's not dysfunctional. He is our NHL insider with TVS Sports. You met him at the Hockey Hall of Fame, didn't you?
I sat behind him. I don't know if he remembers, but I sat behind him. And
Ren's a baseball guy, no?
He's a Yankee fan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure.
Oh.
We'll have to grill him on that one.
We will for sure. Ren Lavoie's next. It's Writer's Block on Sport. A Yankees fan. On Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360.
They're not afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Tim Leeper. Oh, I got to do a read here. I forgot a read. Tune in until December 10th for Air Canada's ideal sporting destinations for your next chance or your chance to win two seats in Air Canada's fan flight to see the Raptors play in Phoenix. Your next ideal sporting destination is Paris. Collect at least five of the destinations and then listen for your cue to call on Wednesday, December 11th for your chance to win. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. This contest is open to Ontario residents. Favorite European city, because I know you've traveled.
Ooh, good, great question. Paris. It's great.
Yeah.
Even with the protests going on, I'd still go there. Great food. I love it. I think the people are great, too.
I got Lisbon was my favorite city I've been to.
Yeah.
I love Lisbon.
I'm going to be in Lisbon at the end of next week doing a baseball camp. So
a baseball camp
doing
in Lisbon?
A baseball camp in Lisbon.
Do they need like a media coordinator? Or
we could maybe work that out.
That would not
we
be
we pay
bad.
In wine.
Well, that's even better. that's fine. I mean, the government can't tax you in wine as far as I know. So I'm good with that. That's no problem. Portuguese wine is fine.
Oh, beautiful.
Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider in TVS Sports. He joins us in Writer's Block. Ren, thank you so much for joining us. I have to admit, I think a lot less of you now after Tim Leeper told me that you're a Yankees fan.
Well, Tim knows. and yes, I am a big fan of the New York Yankees since I was, I think in the late 70s, so around, I guess, 4, 5, 6 years old, something like that. I remember Reggie Jackson playing for the Yankees.
And all right. Bronx is burning.
It started early. It really started early, and it's a great relationship between myself and the Yankees.
There you go. So you're a Yankees fan, and you cover the Canadians. That's not bad. Yeah. Exactly. You got the historical stuff pretty much nailed, I would say.
Yeah, and I remember, you know that Lula Moriello was on the Yankees board, right?
Yes.
For a while, and for a long time, actually. And I remember when he was still president and GM of the Devils, he asked me to come in his office, and he wanted to show me, George Steinbrenner left him. And it was really interesting to see. And he asked me that question because I always... You know, I have two daughters. One, she's the last one. She's 2 years old, so she doesn't know about baseball, obviously. But the oldest one, starting at a young age, I was going in Tampa for the Canadiens game, and I was bringing her to see the Yankees. And mm-hmm. I always made sure that the Yankees were quote unquote part of the family. It's not something. It's not a religion, but you know. And Lula Moriello asked me, why do you like the Yankees so much? And I said to him, I said, the value of that franchise is unique because since George Steinbrenner obviously decided to be the owner at one point in the 70s, I said, or the 80s, I always felt that he did everything to make sure that, you know, he'll bring championship year after year and to make sure that the fans will be satisfied. And for me, that's what sports should be. The owners should always think about the fans first, about bringing championship. It's not going to happen year after year, obviously, especially in this day of age. But the mentality, as you always need to be number one, it's tough not to like it. Personally, that's my feeling.
All right, what did George Steinbrenner leave him?
great question.
You know what? That's a great question. Some stuff that he had in his office at the old Yankee Stadium. I don't remember exactly what.
But office stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but more office stuff. Obviously, Lou had a couple of rings,
right.
The two 2009 rings. He has one. I think he has more. I think Lula Moriello learned a lot, too. He was a friend of George Steinbrenner, obviously. And, you know, Lula Moriello's mentality was always about bringing championship. And it's the first thing that he mentioned when he arrived with the Toronto Maple Leafs. He compared mm-hmm. that franchise to the Yankees. I didn't agree with him at the time. I still don't, because championship are not part of the Maple Leafs history since
whoa,
a long
whoa,
time.
Whoa. Come on.
Well,
that's true. Believe me. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. If you were saying that about the Montreal Canadiens, I would have understand. But honestly, let's be honest here, and no disrespect to the Maple Leafs, but when I remember, I guess it was 5, 6 years ago, I was on a plane landing at Pearson, and the pilot said, welcome to Toronto, home of the 1967 Stanley Cup. And I said to myself, wow, this is quite something when the pilot is teasing the Toronto Maple Leafs fans that are on the plane. It's unique.
Probably a pilot from Montreal. So, Ren, the Leafs are going to take on the Blues on Saturday. How surprised should we be that the Blues have been able to, you know, avoid a championship hangover given the injuries they've had? They're still 18-6-6.
Yeah.
And, you know, Justin Falk, one of their big new acquisitions, his numbers have been modest. How surprised should we be that this team has been able to keep it together and actually more than keep it together, but be atop the Western Conference right now?
Yeah, they didn't make tons of changes, obviously. I think, you know what, that run last year in the playoffs gave them so much confidence. Let's be honest here. I don't think that they started the playoffs thinking that they'll be a Stanley Cup champion at the end. And I feel like Game 7 in Boston proved a lot to that franchise. Not only to the players, but the franchise. Jordan Binnington is making the difference. Even some ex-goalies that I know are starting to say that he's a good goaltender. Wow. Mm-hmm. It took a while, but you know, the older goalies, they don't want to talk about the new goalies coming in and give them too much credit too early. I understand why. But now Jordan Binnington, doesn't have to prove anything much. I feel like he's actually right now one of the best goalies in the league. And when you have a great goaltender, because you have to call him a great goaltender right now, it's giving the rest of the team so much confidence. They know that their goalie is going to stand tall night after night. And Jeff, we mentioned that a lot over the years, that when you have a really good goaltender, you're going to play with an edge. That's the reality. You're going to feel comfortable. You're not going to think when you're playing. And that's why I'm pretty sure that for the coaches right now in St. Louis, it must be a blast, because there was, I'm pretty sure, a year ago, tons of headaches. It wasn't fun to be a St. Louis Blues a year ago. And you look at them today, it's just amazing, the turnaround. They really do have really good players, especially at the blue line, really good first line, really good fourth line. But, the difference in my mind is really Jordan Binnington. He arrived in January, and I'm pretty sure that he's one of the players in the league right now who doesn't want 2019 to stop, because it was a hell of a run.
Mm-hmm. Circling back to the Leafs a little bit, looking at them, do you think there's a way out of this for them where they can actually play better and be the team they were late last year? And if not, what kind of hard moves or hard decisions could they make to make them a team that's going to be a good playoff team?
You mean the Toronto Maple Leafs or the St. Louis Blues?
Toronto Maple Leafs.
The Toronto Maple Leafs. That's a great question.
Pushing the spot there.
Yeah, I know. It's such a great question because, you know, I remember when 2 weeks and a half ago they fired Mike Babcock. I didn't really agree with that move, but it's not my decision. Obviously, it's just me saying, you look at that group and there's a lot of question marks. And obviously the first three games with their new coach, it was great to watch. Felt like they were walking on water. But the reality is going to hit you at one point. And that's in a way, I think they're playing good hockey. You look at the game in Philly this week. In my mind, it was kind of a fluke, four goals like that at the end of the third period. We don't see that too often in the league. So you can't base, your thoughts about the Maple Leafs this week on that game. That's my feeling. They play well, really well versus the Avalanche. The problem is Colorado is a better team. So honestly, I do believe that they're probably right now changing a little bit the way that they're playing the system. Coaches don't like to mention that they're tweaking the system. That's something that they don't want to say anymore, because They don't want to give the other team that they're facing a heads up on what's coming. Montreal did exactly the same thing last week after that game that they lost at home versus the New York Rangers. They decided to tweak the way they were playing defensively, so that's why it was a really an ugly week last week for the Montreal Canadiens. This week it's a little better. So I feel the Toronto Maple Leafs are going through the same process here. They obviously they're going to tweak some things. I think Sheldon Keefe is a really good coach. I mean, in the minors he was great, and in junior he was great. I don't see him as a bad coach at all. I think he's going to turn that ship around. But it's going to be a battle for, I'm pretty sure, till the end to see that team making the playoffs. I mean, it's there. I don't like really their fourth line. This is nothing against Jason Spezza. He's got a great career, but you know, you had a guy like Connor Brown playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs last year on the fourth line. Mm-hmm. I'm watching him play right now with the Ottawa Senators. It's the kind of players that's missing, I feel, right now in Toronto.
Yeah, and you know, it's like so much focus in this city was on Mike Babcock and the coaching change, and you know, and how Sheldon Keefe was playing Tyson Barrie with Morgan Riley, and he's done everything and changed the power play and all that stuff. But Ren, you know, I I'll give Freddie Anderson credit for stepping up and saying I want to play in those back to back games. But more than anything else, I'm looking at a team that's 13-13-4.
Yeah.
And they got 30 points out of 30 games. And Ren, you know, there you don't have to do a whole bunch of I think they're still going to make the playoffs, but you don't have to do an awful lot of complicated math to come to the conclusion that they may not make the playoffs either. And I never thought I'd be saying that at this time of the year.
Well, they're probably one injured player away again of probably struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch Marner came back. And that kind of injury, we all know it's not going to be easy for him to find his rhythm. It's going to take a while. That's what I think. Probably I'll be wrong, but good. And you know, if it's the case, I'll be happy for Mitch Marner and the Toronto Maple Leafs. You know, you don't like to see players being injured like that, especially the really good players. But let's say you look at the Montreal Canadiens, and I don't want to compare the two teams, but you see a different team right now without Jonathan Drouin and Paul Byron. It's a totally different team. They were playing with an edge before those two guys went down 3 weeks ago in Washington. And since then, they're struggling. You look at Mitch Marner. Yes, the Maple Leafs played well, but they had to fire the coach to see that team getting back on track. So you're probably one key defenseman, injury-wise away of struggling again to make the playoffs. So hopefully, knock on wood, it's not going to happen. But because of, you know, the way the NHL is right now, it's so complicated. You know it better than anybody with the salary cap and the issue in Toronto and in a lot of places around the league right now. So that's why it's really tough to find help from anywhere. I'm pretty sure that all the GMs are talking right now, and they're always on the verge of doing something, but they get a call from their salary cap guy saying, hey, we can't do that because it's going to hurt you, probably not this year, but it's probably going to hurt you in next season. So you don't have always to think about what's going to come in the next few weeks. You need to think about next season. It's a real puzzle. It's complicated, and that's why we don't see much trade-wise in the league right now.
Do you think we may see something from the New Jersey Devils in terms of trades at some point? I mean, they fired their coach. Yeah. They appear to be poised to go even deeper into a rebuild. What do you expect to see from the Devils?
Well, obviously Taylor Hall is going to be traded. There's something happened obviously last week. I think the discussions for an extension collapsed totally, between the Devils and his agent. And after that, when they saw what happened in Buffalo, that big loss in Buffalo. John Hines and Taylor Hall, they were really close. They were really close. And they, knowing that Taylor Hall will be traded to during the season, probably Ray Shiro said, you know, it's not going to – if I have to change my coach, right now is the right time, because for sure Taylor Hall is not coming back here. So, yes, he's going to be traded at one point. It's going to be really interesting to see where Colorado, I feel, is – probably the place where the New Jersey Devils would love to make a trade because of, first of all, you know, cap-wise, there's no issues for the Avalanche, and they have a lot to offer. So we'll see. Is Joe Sakic going to resist? I know he mentioned that he wants to make sure the chemistry will be good, that he's not going to mess with his dressing room. But Taylor Hall, believe me, I don't see him as a guy who's going to come in the room and, you know, start to say to the rest of the group, start following me, or this guy is not a good guy. That's not the type of guy that he is. He wants to win a Stanley Cup. And in the long run, is he going to stay in Colorado? I know he really likes Canada. My understanding is when he was traded from Edmonton to Jersey, it was a shock for him. And if he can find a spot in Canada starting next year, why not? But we'll see. Playing in Colorado, I think, will be a great spot for him in the long run.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about Colorado. Of course, they came through here this week. And I keep forgetting, and every now and then I have to shake my head when I take a look at Nathan McKinnon's contract.
Yeah.
And just how much that has kept the door open for Colorado. Yeah. Colorado could turn this into a 3 or 4 year thing if they play their cards right. They really can.
Oh, they really can. And you know, it started with that Matt Duchene trade, changed everything for that franchise. People were laughing at them. Let's be honest here. They had a GM who was still there, Joel Sakic. He wasn't capable of making any moves. It was a really tough situation for him. There was a lot of pressure on his shoulders. And when he made that trade with Ottawa, that three-way trade in Nashville, my God, it changed everything. What he got in return was magic. And you look at Ottawa, the way they're struggling. You look at Nashville right now, they're struggling too. You have to say that Joe Sakic easily won that trade. And I really believe it changed the way not only the players, you know, just the perception. Suddenly they were fun to watch. Suddenly they became a team, and it wasn't the case maybe 2 years ago. So now we're looking at Joel Sakic, ton of respect, everybody around the league. They're looking at the Avalanche, and do they really need help? That's a question.
Mm-hmm.
But with so much cap space, you have to say to yourself, why am I going to lose? Because that window, yes, is open right now. And we were mentioning, is it going to be open in 3 or 4 years? But remember one thing, guys. We were exactly saying the same thing about the Winnipeg Jets.
That's true.
3 years ago.
Yep.
Okay? And look, I know they're playing well right now, but that decor is not the same. Suddenly, it collapsed when you look at the way that that franchise was built. So it's good to see that they're playing well again, but is that window still open for Stanley Cup and the Winnipeg Jets? I'm not convinced that that window is open right now.
Good stuff, Ren. We'll let you run. As always, have a great weekend.
Yeah, enjoy your weekend, and it's going to be fun to talk to you next week.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks, Ren.
Ren LeVar, NHL insider with TVS Sports. Again, a reminder, the Blues and Leafs, 7 o'clock tomorrow night on Hockey Night in Canada, 6:30 Hockey Night in Canada pregame, Leafs Nation postgame with Al Berga and Stellick right after the final horn on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Eric Smith is our Raptors radio analyst on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. The Raptors lost 119-109 to the Houston Rockets last night. James Harden was kind of a...
They did everything right.
They did everything right, exactly. They followed the game plan to a T. Unfortunately, the Rockets, they had their own ideas. And we'll, you know what? It'd be interesting. We'll ask Eric Smith if Nick Nurse had a redo. If they were facing the Rockets tonight, you know, in the second part of a back-to-back or something like that, would Nick Nurse run out the same defense? We'll find out. Eric Smith joins us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Toronto Raptors lost 119-109 to the Houston Rockets last night. Back-to-back losses. For those of you who thought they wouldn't lose a game the rest of the season, back-to-back losses to the Miami Heat and the Houston Rockets. And quite frankly, no disrespect necessarily losing to Miami, who's one of the real surprise teams this year. And Houston last night, we talked about it at the top. Tim Leeper, my special guest co-host today, we talked about this at the top. You decide to stop James Harden. You basically prevent him from scoring, although we did get 23 points, but you basically prevent him from scoring. It's just that the fourth, fifth, and sixth options couldn't miss. It was like the best – talk about the best laid plans of mice and men going astray. Eric Smith is our Raptors radio analyst on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, joining us in Writer's Block. So, Eric, you've I do believe you have covered every game of the Nick Nurse era. Has he lost his genius label now as a result of what happened last night? Well, how come there was no more jankiness? I wanted jankiness.
I'll tell you what. I mean, on one hand, you could argue that the plan sort of worked in the sense that they got the ball out of the hands of James Harden, but I don't think you're anticipating Ben McLemore going for, 8 threes and 28 points.
Yeah, who would have thought that with Drake in the crowd, McLemore would be the more successful? I was trying to play like a McLemore Drake.
I'm sorry.
That was nice. That was good.
McLemore had a big night
for
with
a middle-aged
Drake
guy.
There. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's my street cred shot. Let me ask you, honestly, Eric, if he had a redo, would he do the same thing, Nick?
I think he would.
Okay.
I mean, part of the reason I say that is, I even said it to Jonesy on the air last night as we were talking. What do? We are Monday morning quarterbacks, and Tim's now getting a taste of being on both sides of this. second guessing the coaches all the time.
Yeah, but he was never at fault, so it didn't matter.
I second guess Gibby. I second guess Gibby like nobody.
Had worked, let's just play the hypothetical, right? It works. McLemore only gets two or three triples. Daniel Helst doesn't go off as well. PJ Tucker, who is a solid shooter, doesn't have the type of night he did. I know I'm throwing a lot of butts at you and ifs and whatever else. But you limit James Harden to a couple of field goals in the first half, to only 7 of 11 from the game. He only gets to the free throw line how many times? Less than 10 times.
Yep.
He's been going 10, 15, 20 plus against some teams. The job you did on him worked. In fact, you also did a pretty decent job in terms of containing the dribble, or at least staying with Russell Westbrook and cutting him off at the rim a lot of times on his drive. So the 1-2 punch, you did a pretty damn good job against, but it was the others. So am I willing to risk the others beating me or Harden and Westbrook beating me? So if I were to play the game again, I would consider playing that exact same style again. Shut down Harden, do your best to contain Westbrook as much as possible, and then roll your dice that the supporting cast are not going to make shots at the consistency that they did in last night's game. I don't think that it was a terrible defensive plan, and honestly, I think we'd be sitting here right now saying, so – is Nick Nurse a genius? Is he going to win Coach of the Year 21 games in? Because look at how he designed a defense to shut down LeBron James and Damian Lillard and Kawhi Leonard, and now James Harden as well. It just, like I say, I think I would do it again.
Mm.
In terms of we were just talking about the Blues and Leafs that are playing this week, but like in terms of the injuries that they have come with the Raptors, is it kind of a blessing in disguise where guys are getting like some big minutes against good teams and finding a way to fit in the system a little bit better?
I think so, Tim. And I'll go even beyond the injuries. I think we saw even on opening night, and I think Jeff, you and I might have talked about this last week or something. Opening night, Norm Powell had a chance to win the game for the Raptors before they ultimately had to go to overtime against the Pelicans to win a game. And I remember kind of quizzically looking at that and thinking, Norm Powell, why is it not Pascal Siakam? Why is it not Kyle Lowry taking the shot? And I think that was a teachable moment right away from game one of the season. It's not just game one we're trying to win or trying to figure our guys out. It's all right, well, now Norm proved what he can or can't do in a situation or that play prove that it can or can't work in that situation. I can go back to it in game 30 and game 70 in you know, the second round of the playoffs. And I think, Tim, to your point, we're now kind of, we've seen that with the injuries piled up. Suddenly now guys play heavy minutes. You know now what you can get from a Terrence Davis as a rookie and that he's not scared of the moment. You know that you can lean on Chris Boucher a little bit more than perhaps you were anticipating doing so had you been healthy. Matt Thomas, unfortunately, got hurt as well, but when he was playing with the injuries that had come along, suddenly you start to realize, oh, there's another rookie that can come in and make shots, but also stay on the floor because he was actually doing a pretty decent job on the defensive end of keeping his guy in front of him and not looking like a complete stiff on the defensive end. He was solid enough to get regular minutes. And then further to that point, a guy that was down in the rotation that we all anticipated being a major part of the rotation coming into training camp, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. In not so many words to him in training camp, Nick Nurse basically said a lot of these new guys, they're not playing as hard or as well as we need them to on our team and the way we play. And it was kind of, in my opinion at least, an indirect or direct message to guys like Stanley Johnson and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and the rookies, Terrence Davis, Matt Thomas, that, hey, you're joining a championship team. We've set the bar at a certain level, and you have to adapt to us and play our style. And a veteran like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson was not playing to start the year. Suddenly the injuries happened. He was thrust in the lineup, and he clearly has proven that he got that wake-up call, and now he's a regular part of the rotation, and deservedly so.
You know, you and Jonesy made a good point during the broadcast last night. And, and look, first of all, I'm going to credit James Harden, and Mike D'Antoni did the same thing. You know, James Harden can play good post-up defense. He's not a great defender, but he can play good post-up defense. So I'll give him credit for that. And I frankly thought he was a better player defensively for great swaths of last night game than offensively. But I did note, you know, Pascal Siakam had a certain amount of success against him. And I know part of it was James Harden maybe locking him down a bit, but it almost seemed as if the Raptors went away from that. And I know you guys mentioned that. In the third quarter, I think it was, I made a note about it when you guys were talking about it. It was 74-62 Houston. And you started to see Toronto have a little bit of success with Pascal going right at him. Were you a little surprised that kind of went away?
I was. And I mean, the fact that Pascal went scoreless in the fourth quarter,
yes,
kind of emphasizes the point that you're making, Jeff. Yeah, I was. And if I'm recalling the conversation specifically, it wasn't necessarily just Pascal attacking Harden. It was anybody attacking Harden.
Correct.
And then knowing the angles to play because, in fact, kind of, you know, on the flip side, as much as Pascal was having success on Harden, there was a play in which Siakam, I think, brought the ball up across center, kept it himself, drove on Harden, but didn't kind of play the angle right, didn't get on the shoulder of Harden, and ended up getting denied at the rim on pretty decent defense by Harden, kind of staying with him to the hoop. And I think Capella came in to contest the shot as well, whereas maybe the next possession or two possessions later, Van Vliet came in, played the proper angle, turned the corner, and just blew by Harden with ease and got right to the rim and finished in traffic. And I think that's what spurred the conversation about just playing that proper angle, but then also recognizing that, hey, he might be decent in the post. He might be decent even in the open court trying to use his quick hands and slap the ball away. But with one quick move and with that, again, I say proper angle, you can beat him relatively easily, and you've got to recognize those moments and go after it. And to answer your question more succinctly, yeah, I was surprised they didn't go, you know, to it more and to try and attack and expose him that much more, especially in that fourth quarter. Mm.
Do you, when you have a defensive alignment like this, and obviously it was a huge part of the game planning yesterday, how much does that affect the offensive side of things?
I think it does. Van Vliet after the game, Tim, said that he was not anticipating or expecting having to run the miles or put on the mileage that he did because he was often the help. He was often the trap. So, you know, just to speak of one guy specifically, I think it does affect your offensive end when you're working that much more, when it's run to Harden, get back to your guy, make sure you're shifting and rotating, and you're just putting on that much more mileage, twice the mileage that you would be normally if you're just playing guys straight up. So I think it definitely has an impact. It takes some of your legs out of you. And I know that, you know, for what it's worth, some of the fans, even after the game, just talking about even a guy like Ibaka, who is two games back into the lineup and maybe just not quite there yet with the conditioning, with the legs. And should the Raptors have gone back to a guy like Gasol, you know, a little bit earlier than what they did, because he just seemed like he didn't have the energy. So I think if you're going to play that style and that trapping style and be kind of back and forth all over the place on the defense, man, it might mean that, yeah, you have to go a little bit deeper in your bench to keep the fresh legs and to keep guys fresh for the offensive end, just so you have them, at their top towards the end of the ballgame.
Hey, were you surprised? Pardon me. I'm not going to turn this into a hammer on Toronto fans thing, especially Raptors fans, because Raptors crowds are pretty noisy. But I also think you guys mentioned this, and I made a note during the introduction, and I just thought maybe, I don't know, I thought maybe I wasn't paying attention. Man, it was muted. That was not a normal Raptors crowd. Like I didn't expect. I don't hate James Harden and Russell Westbrook, but you know what happens when LeBron gets introduced? I mean, there's kind of the cheers and the boos, and but man, it was almost like it was. Eric, it felt like it was Memphis coming in on a Thursday night. I just found it really weird.
Yeah, I said that to Jonesy right when the intros happened. Yeah. It was indifference.
Which is maybe good because they're not, James Harden, who cares? But I expected a little more, a little more hate, maybe.
Well, and I'll tell you, maybe it's, I agree with you for one, just kind of being devil's advocate to my own point that I made last night. I'm agreeing with you. I was surprised by it. Perhaps it's the case that, well, first of all, I know there are people banging on the radio right now saying, well, it's because it's Houston. It was one of the top tickets and the real fans weren't in the building. It was all the folks in Gucci Row and the fat cats with all the money that were buying the tickets. So the quote unquote real fans weren't able to be there. And I'm sure there's probably some element of truth to that to some extent, but it might also be the championship. Raptor fans now are coming to watch the Raptors. You know, gone are the days where you're buying tickets to see the opposition and okay, yeah, I'm a Raptor fan and I just want to see some good NBA ball. And okay, yeah, my team is there. They're a playoff team. They're a 40-win team, a 45-win team, even a 50-win team. No. We're the reigning champs now. I don't care about James Harden. I don't care about Russell Westbrook or Houston. I'm here to watch the Raptors, so I'm not going to cheer for you. I'm not going to give you the respect of just because you're a star, a superstar in the game, I'm going to automatically cheer for you or even boo for you. I don't care about you. I care about my team. Maybe there's part of that. But we do see, whether it's LeBron, whether it's Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, I'm sure for Kawhi Leonard as well, it's as many boos as cheers, which makes for an audible noise of some sort. It, you notice it. Whereas last night, it was kind of dead. And I will say, as you kind of said, Jeff, not to rag on the fans, I made another note kind of in the fourth quarter. And listen, if I went through the schedule and went through all 82 games plus playoffs, there are going to be far more games where the crowd is outstanding and loud and in your face and coming down the throat of the opponents. And you've heard how players and coaches now talk about Toronto being one of the most difficult places to come to. And I emphasize this, but there were moments last night in the fourth quarter when the Raptors had come back yet again to pull within one and trying to take the lead and whatever else, it was kind of dead in there. Mm. Like I just think that it was just sort of one of those flat nights where you weren't getting a lot. Maybe you weren't getting a lot from the team and you weren't getting a lot from the crowd. It was just kind of flat. Whereas even on Tuesday night against Miami, again, another kind of flat start for the Raptors. Big comeback turned into obviously one hell of a game going to overtime. But that crowd was amped from the get-go. Even when Toronto was down big, I thought that they were really rallying Toronto on, even when they were down double figures, whereas I didn't get that same sense last night.
Yeah. No, I wonder if maybe James Harden had one of those games. Maybe the crowd would have been more energized. So maybe Nurse took James Harden and the crowd out of the game. That's awful. I can't believe I said that. And I didn't mean it. Tim, go ahead.
Are you surprised? Now, this is not second-guessing, but maybe you can explain some more. The amount of minutes Kyle Lowry's been on the floor since coming back and from injury.
Honestly, Tim, I'm not. And the only reason I would say that is the Raptors have often, kind of lived by the mantra of when you come back, you're coming back because you're healthy. You're not coming back because we could have maybe kept him out another game, another day or two, another week. If you're back, you're back and you're ready to go. Clearly there's no denying, and Kyle will be the first to admit it, he struggled mightily in his first game back. I thought he was pretty solid last night.
Yeah.
Even just numbers aside, I thought he played pretty well for Toronto and I think what is happening now, beyond just Kyle, it's a feeling out process of trying to relearn how to play with one another. You were missing these guys for 10-plus games, and I think that there's going to be an adjustment period now of trying to figure out rotations and minutes and roles and shots and who's got the ball and all that stuff. And I think that kind of plays more into, the struggles maybe Toronto's had in the two games, Miami and Houston, but then also, to your point, even the minutes, it could be, I want to get these guys more minutes on the floor together. I want to play them alongside each other together. And we even saw, Tim, late in the game yesterday, a couple of possessions where Lowry was bringing the ball up in the fourth quarter, and then it was switched. It was flipped where, for whatever reason, Nurse decided, no, you know what? I want Kyle now off the ball, and Freddie's going to bring up the ball. And whether it was by design or try and throw off Houston or otherwise, I think he likes having those two guys together. As long as Fred's leading the league in minutes played, and again, a lot of that was because of Kyle being out, but if that's going to kind of maintain or sustain even with Lowry back, then I think you're probably going to see Lowry on the floor with Fred quite a bit because he likes running those two guards.
Yep.
Eric, we're going to let you run. Appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much, man.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Good talking to you.
Eric Smith, our Raptors radio analyst on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And again, the Raptors 119-109 losers to the Houston Rockets. And it's a classic example, as I said, of what happens when you, you design defense for one player and it works out well and everybody else steps up. Interesting. The Raptors, and this is just a note I made through the third quarter, and I don't know if it necessarily changed. It did change in the third quarter. The Raptors didn't have the lead for the entire first half at any point in the game, and that's something that hasn't always happened this year. I think Eric's right. If you play that game over again, you probably do. Probably do the same thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, and the other thing I will say, and it doesn't get mentioned enough. I don't know if this was part of Nick Nurse's thinking, but going into the game, Daniel House of Houston was really under the weather. He was taking IV, taking fluid for illness. So he ended up having a pretty good game. And who knows? Maybe that was part of Nick Nurse's thinking as well. They've got a guy in that team. We know he's ill. But again,
we have these conversations. It shows how far we've come as a basketball city and how far they've come as a team. Like, we're breaking down defenses. We're doing things like we're talking about game planning and the fact that they're going to get in the playoffs and the fact that all these things that look like they might not be great. And I lost a couple of games and I know there's a little bit of panic, but these are blessings.
These are
ways to really grow. And I think they're making full use of it.
Oh, absolutely. And the one thing we know about Nick Nurse and Nick, somebody made this point about him during the playoffs. Nick Nurse takes notes. Like, he'll know what worked and what didn't work by the time the playoffs roll around. And, you're going to see the triangle and two and the box and one at some point down the road. But, it's strange because one of the things the Raptors did so well last year, and it wasn't just Kawhi, it's one of the things they, other than LeBron, there have been times where they've done a pretty good job of taking the game's big players out. You know, there are guys who, like, James Harden plays well against the Raptors. Jimmy Butler, it's like he's... he's already a good player, but it's like he's five times the player he is when he plays the Raptors. That just happens. But they do have success taking sort of those big names out of games at time. And I think if I'm Nick Nurse, I play it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And your question was great about the offensive part of it, because I don't think the Raptors lost that game last night because of their defense or Houston's offense. I think they lost it because of their offense. And your point was well made. That's got to take a lot of energy out of you. If you're running, if you're the second guy in the trap, you're doing an awful lot of quick running. And then
your legs. You need your legs to shoot. You need your legs for everything.
Exactly. Then you're being asked to shoot.
But it's great that they did it, because next time they go there, they're going to be a little bit more prepared for it. And these are the type of things that you need to do to win championships. And that it's great that we've elevated our game to that point where
absolutely.
We can play like this.
Absolutely. And the other thing, too, is the next time they do this, Kyle will be more in rhythm. And I think Eric was right about that. Kyle's such an important player. But this team played so well without him that I think it's just understandable. And it's not that anybody's upset that Kyle's back, but it's going to take a while for all the pieces to kind of fit together again, because this team wasn't playing that well when Kyle was hurt. Now it's playing well. And we'll see.
You're obviously a better team. You need him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're a better team. I mean, this is like St. Louis. They need Tarasenko. I think when it comes down to it, you need your best players.
Absolutely. We'll take a break, come back, put a bow on it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan of Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Tell me, quando, 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 we can share a love divine. Please don't make me wait again.
All right. Welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590. This is too much fun. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet 360. Tim and Sid are next. As is always the case at 5 o'clock, Tim Leeper has been alongside me for three hours today, and he survived. And quite impressed with that that you've been able to pull through. he said, laughing. As we mentioned, the winter meeting starts Sunday in San Diego. Shai Davidi, Ben Nicholson, Smith, Hazel May will be down there for Sportsnet. We'll have you covered in any breaking news. I'll just as we wrap this up, Tim, are you expecting, because we've seen the winter meetings in recent years essentially turn into nothing other than a setting for Scott Boras to hold one or two news conferences.
Always entertaining.
But it's always entertaining. Find the Christmas tree, set a chair by there. At some point, Scott Boras is going to come and talk to you around the Christmas tree. but we have seen a lot of activity ahead of the winter meetings, you know, and some serious signing, Zach Wheeler signing. Do you think we're going to see a busy week, or do you think that, you know, we are going to kind of slip back into what we quite often see with baseball, and that everybody will kind of pull their horns until after Christmas?
I think that first domino has to fall, and I think that will create like a little bit of a frenzy, and I think it's probably going to come from a trade. Mm-hmm. And there's some teams that definitely need to upgrade, with Toronto obviously being one of them and looking to do some things. And I think once that first domino falls, I think it could become, you know, more, I think more trades and free agent signings for sure.
Yeah. Because it seems as if Scott Boras has every free agent on the market right now, to be honest, including Dallas Keuchel. He's got Hyunjin Ryu. And I'm kind of with you. I think this may be one of those winter meetings where you see a trade kind of get everything going, as opposed to somebody big coming off the board. Because look, unless San Diego decides they want to make a splurge because they're in San Diego, and I know teams don't think that way anymore, but if you're the Padres and you want to take a real run at signing Steven Strasburg and having a big announcement down by the waterfront and all that, then maybe I can see one of those guys going off the board. But boy, Scott Boras likes to slow play the market, and I can see maybe a trade happening.
And he's acting a little quicker this year on some things. I think the other interesting scenario is, like, they're going to have to hand down some punishment for the Astros at some point. Now, do they want – I thought it was
That's
coming this
point.
Week. I was told it would come this week, and it obviously hasn't. So I'm curious if they don't do it now. I don't think that's something you want to do and when you're trying to, like, market your game at the biggest time of the year. But that's going to definitely come down in a couple of weeks. But it's also going to get some legs because people are going to be talking about it with everybody there.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, MLB Network will be down there. And you know, if the commissioner wanted to make a point, winter meetings would be a pretty good time to make a point. But
it'll be very telling to see whether it happens or whether it doesn't.
Yeah, and I don't know where that – I mean, you know, I've just talked to a couple of people about it, and there are a lot of people who think that it's going to be a pretty serious punishment. Defined pretty serious, I don't know. I've been told it'll be more than draft picks.
Yeah, it's going to affect more than one team as well.
Oh, I think so too. I frankly wouldn't surprise me if you don't see some suspensions coming out of this. That's where I think this may be going if the commissioner really wants to send a message. There are a lot of rumors, obviously, going to these meetings, names like Francisco Lindor. The Chicago Cubs have put some of their players up, not for auction, but have made some of their players available, according to a lot of rumors. So we will see what happens, and we will see if the Toronto Blue Jays are able to address their pressing concerns, which is pitching, and an outfielder. I think that's a pretty safe way of putting it.
I think that's good.
Tim, thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. We will be back on Monday. Donovan Bennett joins me. The Monday Roundtable. We'll have Shai Davidi live from the winter meetings. Tim and Sid are next. Enjoy your weekend, everybody.